Blog Talk Radio.
Show with Rodney Lee Conover out in California, as well as myself, Scott Osborne, out in Texas, the number one state for business in the United States of America, of course. We are going to have a great show tonight. We've got all kinds of fun things to talk about, interesting things nationally in the news and locally in the news. We're going to have some great guests on tonight. We're going to have one of my favorite people in the whole wide world on tonight. He is a friend and one of the smartest people I know. Let me tell you, when Rich Lowry comes on the show, or if I get on the phone and talk to Rich Lowry, by the time I get done, I feel like I should have earned credits in a university course on economics. He understands the foundation of our American economic system better than anybody I know. And boy, is he going to have some great things to say. We're also going to have Joe Rosbacher, also known as Joe the Plumber, calling in here in a couple of minutes and joining Rodney and I for some good discussion. And we're just going to take it. You know how it is, Rodney. We laugh a little, cry a little, but we keep pushing on in this great country. We fight every day for it, and this is one of the ways we do it. Rodney, how you doing?
Good. Try to keep the crying to a minimum tonight, Scott, because if you start bawling like you usually do, you're going to miss some of what Rich Lowry says, and you'll have to make it up on Saturdays. And you never want to go into class on Saturday to make up what you missed for on Thursday nights. I know what you're talking about with Rich. Every time I talk to him, I've got to, you know, especially if I'm in a group, a small group of people listening to Rich Lowry, when he says something, then I have to turn to the small group and I have to tell them what Rich said. I have to do, you know, I have to explain it to them in layman's terms. But don't worry. Rich has assured us that tonight he's going to lay out the entire problem with the economy together with some simple fixes, some simple layman's terms fixes for you, and it'll be great. I mean, this guy has really, really opened my eyes, and I'm sure you too, Scott, in all seriousness, about what is at the core, not just at the core of our economic malaise, as we say over here in the desert, but how it applies to Republicans losing elections. Now, to me, that is what is killer about Rich Lowry, is he doesn't just sit there, Scott Osborne, he doesn't just sit there and piss and moan about what's wrong with the economy. Unemployment's too high. The stock market, it's a big house of cards. We got the stupid, interest rates. They're at zero. That's baloney. That's not real. It's that stupid quantitative easing. We get rid of that. Inflation, blah, blah, blah. He doesn't do that. He lays it all out, and then he says, okay, here's what we need to do in order to connect with voters. And when I say we, I'm talking about the Republican Party, because let's face it, that's the party we're stuck with as conservatives. And as many of our loyal listeners know, I tried my best to leave the Republican Party, but Scott Osborne wouldn't let me leave. Isn't that true, Scott Osborne?
Very, very true, and everything you said about Rich Lowry is 100%. And, you know, we understand that our economy is based on certain things. We also understand that our economy can be messed with very easily. And, you know, the message we're going to get out tonight is one that we need to get out to everybody. If you are supporting, if you're supporting a candidate, get them in contact with Rich Lowry. Rich Lowry can help them to explain to a candidate exactly what they need to do to explain to their constituents, to the people that they're listening to, how to exactly sell the economy. And with that, Rodney, I'll pass it back to you.
Well, it's really amazing how a guy like a guy like Rich Lowry, he can take a ginormous concept, like for instance income inequality. Now, listen, I'll be honest with you. For most of my life, if you would have said to me, you know, income inequality is a problem, I would have said, well, yeah. And I wouldn't have known even what you're talking about. You know, I'm just being honest. And most people are just parroting what they hear on radio or what they hear Jay-Z say or what they hear on Oprah or what they hear on Rush Limbaugh. And they're just parroting what they say. And that's fine. Not everybody has the time or the inclination, for that matter, to get a master's degree in economics and really figure out what income inequality is. And that's why I like guys like Rich Lowry, because he can take what is really a complicated bunch of information. You think income inequality is just, well, there's too many rich people and not enough, and too many poor people, and there's a huge gap in between. That's it. Well, yeah, okay, that's what income inequality is, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. In fact, it is a ginormous, yes, that's a word, it's a ginormous concept, and the reasons for income inequality are complex, and they involve politics, they involve economics, they involve human nature, they involve the corrupting of the capitalist system, and you'll be very interested to hear a guy like Rich Lowry break down any one of these big concepts, because it'll open your eyes. And listen, this guy is not a ranting lunatic like myself, and he's just a guy that knows a heck of a lot about economics and how they pertain to the real world. And this is what sets Rich Lowry apart from all other economists, most of them that, you know, bore you to tears. I don't know, Scott, if you ever took an economics class while you were down in Honduras running guns or whatever you were doing. I don't know if you went to a Honduran community college and took a couple of economics classes while you were bored waiting for a shipment or something. But economics, when they say economics 101, let me tell you, that's also known as I fell asleep this morning between 10:40 and 11:15. It is just, I can't blame people for not knowing about economics, because it just makes your eyes roll back in your head. Most people, they just want the economy to work in a logical and reasonable fashion. Most people. But you start tinkering with supply and demand, Scott, you start tinkering, you get your hands in there, you start messing with it. What happened? Tell me, Scott, in a nutshell.
Well, you know what? I've equated it last week, and I'll equate it this week. I equate it to a mixer board for if you're going to have a band in a concert. Once you turn one dial, you got to turn another dial to balance something out. Otherwise, you end up with squeaking. And the more you turn, the more you mess up. And that's what they've been doing. They keep turning the dials and messing with this and messing with that. And when they turn this dial, then it messes something else out. You know, they lower interest rates, and then they got to change something else in order to keep that from being hurt. And it's insane. And Rodney, I'll pass it back to you, but we've got both of our guests on the line. We've got Joe the Plumber is on the line and unmuted, and we've got Rich Lowry sitting there in the line waiting as soon as we get Joe in here and talk for a couple of minutes. So I'll pass it back to you.
Hey, that's good news. Let's bring our buddy Joe Wurzelbacher on. Joe, you know him very well as Joe the Plumber. His name's Joe Wurzelbacher. He's a friend of the show. And a lot of stuff happening this week, Mr. Joe. How are you doing? Is he up here yet, Scott? I don't know how to work the equipment. You probably do. So help me out here, buddy.
Sure is.
Joe, can you hear me?
Oh, there we are.
What's happening, buddy? Have you been busy? What have you been up to?
Well, Rodney and I both have been busy, really pushing the Second Amendment, taking the offensive, as opposed to waiting for your gun grabbing crowd, the anti gun crowd, to come and put us behind the eight ball as they regularly do among conservatives. When tragedies happen or they feel they have the upper hand, they attack the right to bear arms. So Rodney and I have been working, putting out a couple different articles. We had a good friend of ours, Nick Adams from Australia, when Barack Obama talked almost a week ago now about how great the gun laws were down in Australia. I guess he didn't really talk to any Australians. He just figured most Americans, especially his low-information voters that got him in office, would go, well, yeah, it's working on Australia without any knowledge. So we dispelled that myth real quick. That article went really well, got picked up by lots of people. And then I was able to contact some people through the NRA. They did some really great research for us, and we put together an article showing how all the different laws that have been either passed or proposed over the last 5 years, here's the proof. They are chipping away at our gun rights, slowly but surely. It's kind of like, putting a frog in a cool pot of water and then turning it up and boiling them alive. That's what they're doing with our Second Amendment. People say, well, they don't really want your guns. They don't, you shouldn't have this gun or you shouldn't have that gun. That's just a nice way of slowly chipping away at our rights. Kind of like what they did with the Indians back in the day. You can have this land, but you can't have that land. Well, you know what? We want that land back. We're going to give you this land. And finally, well, we all know what happened there. And that's the same thing that's going to happen with our Second Amendment unless we stand up and fight. And so JoeForAmerica.com is trying to be a beacon to encourage people to stand up and not back down, especially when it comes to the Second Amendment.
Yeah, they take away your land, and then the next thing you know, they're taking away your patent for the Washington Redskins. So, you got to look down the road here because they're sneaky like that. But as I understand it, the patent office is reconsidering that it's kind of off the subject here. I understand the patent office is reconsidering the move that they made, taking away the patent, the trademark logo, from the Washington Redskins, Joe. Did you read about that? They're reconsidering because of all the backlash?
No, I didn't hear about that.
Oh, yeah. The government, the patent office, they didn't want to be seen as a bunch of Indian givers. They gave it and they took it back.
Okay, Rod, you set me up for that one. That was good, brother.
Yeah, I did. Listen, Joe, I want to I know you got to get up really, really early in the morning, so I'm going to cut you loose really early, but I would be remiss if I did not bring on the great Rich Lowry, because I want you and him to commiserate a little bit about a funny story that you told me. Scott, if you could work your button magic, I want to bring on...
Hey, everybody's unmuted.
Rich Lowry. Rich, are you there, buddy?
Good evening. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good. You're here with Joe Wurzelbacher, and I wanted to, before I let Joe go, I wanted to ask him a question. He was telling me kind of a funny story about the first time you guys met. What was that, Joe?
Well, let me start off first by saying, because I was listening to the show prior to coming on, you were talking about economists. And, the one thing that I've noticed, and I think a lot of us here have all noticed it, is, the Republicans have their economists, the Democrats have theirs, And it's all about an agenda. It's not actually 2 plus 2 anymore. I mean, Republicans and Democrats can make 2 plus 2 equal, you know, $6 billion if they need to. And that's one thing I liked about Rich is, you know, he was just putting the numbers together to make it work for everybody. It wasn't an agenda for the Republican Party or the Democrat Party. You know, it was an agenda for America. And that's really what I liked about Rich. And when I met Rich, you know, I'm Joe the Plumber. Everybody knows that. I show up at an event, and I'm usually the most comfortable guy there because I'm wearing blue jeans, a T-shirt, and a flannel, and my work boots, because that's pretty much what I like to wear. So after speaking with Herman Cain's people and getting an appointment with Rich, because I really wanted to help Herman and understand 999 a little bit better, we made an appointment, Rich and I, to meet at Cleveland. In Cleveland, at this, I think it's a men's club. I'm not sure. Rich can correct me if I'm wrong. So I show up in my blue jeans, T-shirt, and flannel, and you know, and Rich is, you know, very much the gentleman, you know, and you know, pleasant, you know, to myself, my wife, the campaign manager at the time. And as he's talking, he's taking us upstairs and downstairs and out the door. And I was under the impression we were going to meet there. Come to find out, you know, that was a place where I guess you had to have a jacket or something. So yeah, Rich was very nice and took us down the road to a diner, and we ended up having a great conversation about the 999 play.
Do you have a different version of that story, Rich, or is that pretty much how that went?
No, that was it. We met at the Union Club, and I thought that would be a good home base to meet because at least I knew everybody could park in that garage. And if you know how difficult parking is in Cleveland, you know, otherwise you'd have someone driving around for 15, 20 minutes and then getting, you know, frustrated that they can't find a place to park. So I knew that at least there we could all park and meet, and then we could either go across the street or go upstairs depending on the circumstances. And
I think you're just being kind. I think that Joe showed up and they took one look at Joe at the Union Club and said, you know, we don't let riffraff into this place. Why don't you guys take a hike?
Well,
you know, there's a Denny's outside on the street. I think that's good for you.
I'll side with Joe any day.
Okay. Hey, listen, Joe, thanks a lot for calling in. It's joeforamerica.com. That's joeforamerica.com. Do I got that right?
Yeah, I believe you got that right. I appreciate that. Seeing as how you're right there, it's good that you remember the website every now and then.
That's right. Thanks again, man. Hopefully we'll talk to you next week again. I really appreciate it, Joe.
Hey, you guys have a great show. Thanks a lot.
Okay. All right, back to you, Mr. Lowry. I was singing your praises earlier, and here's what I was saying. There are gigantic or ginormous concepts in the world of economics. And most people, their heads just fall off their shoulders when you start talking about them. That's why you have accountants that do your taxes. That's why you have consultants that help you with stocks. And that's why you have professors that deal with economics, because it's just too hard. I mean, you just got to be really smart to understand these gigantic concepts and how they shape the world. However, you meet and you listen to a Rich Lowry, and he's able to distill, not only distill these giant concepts, but then apply them to the real world. And specifically, what I love about talking to you, Rich, is that you can apply them specifically to politics, to campaigns, to political movements, to swaying a populace, to leading. And, you know, I really dig that. It's really lovely how you can make things work for the average person. And I don't say that in a demeaning way. I mean the average person walking around, I consider myself one of them. And you can say, oh, now I understand what income inequality is, and now I understand why there's X amount of rich people and X amount of poor people. Anyway, did you set out to do that, or did that just kind of you know, come to you in a moment of glory?
No, I think that, you know, I've had the advice of mentors early in my career that say if you can't explain something where an eighth grader can understand it, you don't know the subject well enough. So it kind of puts the burden on you to make sure that you grasp it well enough that you can explain it to anybody. And I think it's part of the game that goes on in Washington where if you make it seem like everything is so complex, it's so difficult, you know, then we need to rely on the experts. And I think that's part of the problem that we're in. As long as you put economics above politics, which is where it should be, it's really quite simple. And if you want, we can kind of walk through a basic model for how you can look at the economy that's fairly easy to grasp. And once you grasp it, you'll know more than 80% of the professional economists out there.
Well, I would love to do that. That is exactly what I want to do. But first I want Scott to jump in here, Scott Osborne, to jump in here. And I want him to give our audience just a little bit, just maybe 30 seconds of background on Rich Lowry, just to give them a little bit better idea if people are less familiar with Rich Lowry than Scott and I, because we know him really well. Scott, are you there?
I sure am, and I just have to welcome Rich. I'll tell you what I always say, Rich, when after I've had you on a show or talked with you, I always feel like I've gotten I should be earning some credits from a university course on economics because these things are important. They're very, very important. And, you know, when you understand the fundamental basics of economics, they're not really that difficult. You know, when we were selling 999, we had a hard time with people because they didn't understand some basic concepts such as embedded taxes and the like, that if the bulk of the American people just understood those basic things, it would not be so difficult. And so with that, I'll pass it back to you, Rodney.
Well, Rich, I thought you had a great idea there. You know, pick a subject or pick a slice of a subject, however you do it, break it down, and apply it to the real world for everybody. I think that'd be great.
Well, I think the first question, the most important question in all of economics, and I think where we get, meaning as a society, get it wrong, is the basic question, does supply drive the economy or does demand? And this is kind of the age-old Keynesian debate that's the equivalent of the debate of a couple centuries ago whether the earth is flat or not. And if you get this wrong, you're going to get everything else wrong that follows. You'll have no foundation to build it on. And if you have trouble, picture going to a deserted island of Alaska where you're the island's only inhabitant. Do you think you can really consume anything before you first produce it? And that kind of puts it in focus. You have to produce first. Only then can you get paid second, and only then can you consume. So, you know, production or supply is the engine. It pulls along consumption just like the engine pulls a caboose. And here we have an administration that's putting fuel in the caboose on the failed theory that consumption or demand drives the economy, and it just doesn't. You'll get into arguments where people say, well, you need demand. You need both. You know, they're joined at the hip. It's a chicken and egg argument. It's a circular argument, and it's not. The way you cut through it is to say, I'll ship you to that island in Alaska, and if you can consume anything before you first produce it, then you have me convinced. Otherwise, they're either going to stay there forever because they can't figure it out, in which case that's a plus for the economy. You know, so if you start with that, do you really think Paul Krugman would go to this island, this deserted island in Alaska, and stand there and clench his fist and say, I demand fish? And then a fish would jump out of the water, fillet itself, fly through some fire, cut itself up into little pieces, dive into his mouth, jump up and down against his teeth just because he demanded it? And if you look at all the policies that are wrong, they're all based on this notion that demand drives the economy. So once you get that right, you're going to know more than 80% of the economists out there, because everybody at the Fed, most of the economists in Washington, are just ingrained with this demand-side model. Once you get the equation right, that supply drives everything and production drives everything, you say, well, what's important to producers? Well, producers want incentives to produce, They don't want government obstacles in their way, and they need a stable unit of measure, in other words, a stable dollar. So all this stuff the Fed's doing, like Scott said, mixing up the soundboard, they should have one role and one role only, and that is provide the private sector producers with a stable unit of measure. A dollar is no different than an hour, a foot, or a pound. And think for a minute how difficult it would be if time floated and an hour wasn't only 60 minutes and a foot always wasn't 12 inches. It would be utter chaos. And that's exactly what we have with a dollar that floats. It has a volatile unit of measure. Then you have a pretty simple way of looking at the economy. Low taxes, because that provides incentives for people to invest, for producers to invest. Business investment is the only thing that drives the economy. Nothing else comes close. There are really three categories. Every dollar of business investment generates about 45 cents of GDP. Every dollar of residential investment generates about 7 cents of GDP. And every dollar of government spending is a wash or negative. It's taking a bucket of water out of the deep end of the pool and pouring it in the shallow end, and then you hope the water level changes. So those are really the only three things. And if you have non-residential business investment generating 45 cents of GDP every year, and the next closest is residential at 7, there's no other game in town. We should be doing every policy should be measured against what does it do to help expand business investment. And the policies should all be aligned around maximizing economic growth.
You know, the thing that got me interested in this subject, I got to be honest with you, this is going to sound crazy, Rich, but the thing that really got me going was I saw an interview with the rap artist Jay-Z, and he was really upset about income inequality, and he was going on and on about how terrible income inequality was. And he had just gotten back from Cuba. He was on some sort of vacation in Cuba with his significant other. And I believe she's famous as well. He just kept talking about income inequality and how terrible it was and how President Obama was going to fix it. And it wasn't long after that when I got into a couple of really terrific conversations with you about income inequality. And it also, and that's when I first heard that story about, hey, you know, we got to stabilize the dollar. We have to fix our monetary policy. And people don't even know what monetary policy is. Monetary policy revolves around the U.S. dollar. How strong or how weak or what is the value of a dollar? That's monetary policy. And right now it's so messed up. And that's the first time we were talking and you cued me in about this story. What, that you just alluded to, what would it be like if you opened a business, small business, large business, whatever, but you opened a business, you had employees, you had products you were going to make them, you were going to sell them. You're going to do everything a businessman does with his business in order to make a profit. How would it affect you if the government decided on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis, if the government decided how long an hour would be? 1 week, that hour would be 30 minutes long. The next week, it would be an hour long. The next week, it would be five minutes long. And it would constantly change.
It would be subject to manipulation. You know that the government would change the definition of an hour and extend the definition forever so that we never ended a quarter with negative GDP. And they could look the American people in the eye with a straight face and say, we're never going to have a recession again. And they could do manipulation like that, that one person in a million wouldn't understand behind the scenes, you know, what's really going on. And the Federal Reserve should be no more significant in the economy than the Office of Weights and Measures. And I don't know if anybody who's listening in even knows who the head of the Office of Weights and Measures is. Arguably, she has as much of an important job as Janet Yellen does, except she comes to work every day and decides to keep an hour at 60 minutes, a foot at 12 inches, a pound at 16 ounces, and then goes home. Imagine if she had the power to float all those. Everybody in the world would know that Carol Hockert is the most important person in the world. And I think that as an ultimate goal, make restraining the Fed so they are no more activist in the economy than the Office of Weights and Measures is kind of the ultimate goal. We do need them as a lender of last resort. So I think to end the Fed is more of a slogan than it is a solution. But a lot of people don't know that the Fed is a central actor in the worsening income inequality. And let me start off by saying we're always going to have an element of income inequality as long as we have freedom, because we have inequality of work ethic, inequality of ambition and motivation, inequality of education, inequality of all the things that are factors that determine somebody's income. That we have to learn to accept. But what we shouldn't tolerate is when the government puts its thumb on the scale and causes worsening income inequality. And I'll give you an example. The bottom 90% of the country has had flat income for the last 4 years. So let that sink in for a little bit. The bottom 90% of the country has flat income for 40 years. That is the one and only problem that the country faces. When I go through the newspapers and I go through the Facebook pages and the Twitter feeds, it seems like we have 100 different big problems going on in the country, from the VA to the tariff swap to the invasion of the southern border and the IRS. The list just goes on and on and on and on and on. But all of that is a distraction from the one and only real problem we have, and it's a simple problem to fix. And that is you have stagnant income with the bottom 90% of the country for the last 40 years. That's why young people are open to socialism. They see that it's not working. That's why college is unaffordable. That's why people vote for redistribution. That's why they resist austerity. That's why Republicans, and the longer Republicans stay silent on this issue, the longer we're going to lose elections. We just stand back there and just take it on the chin, election after election after election. Why don't we step up and acknowledge income to the bottom 90% of the country has been flat for 40 years and pledge to fix it? And once you start looking at how does this arise, because it's not a natural phenomenon, the 20 years prior to that, from 1948 to 1971, income for the same group, income for the bottom 90%, went up 86%. So what would you rather have, 20 years of 86% increase in your income or 40 years of flat income? And back when you had 48 to 71, 86% increase, that was the golden age of the middle class. That's what everybody thought about the American middle class. It certainly isn't the last 40 years where it's been flat. The longer that continues, the more people develop a mindset that something must be wrong with free enterprise. And the more they look to government to say, do something about it. And when government gets involved, they just exacerbate the problem. They slow the rate of economic growth. And the root cause of all of this is the Federal Reserve. They treat wage growth as inflation. So the campaign that we should focus on for 2014 is around one simple question. Is wage growth prosperity or inflation? And if you acknowledge that income for the bottom 90% has been flat for 40 years, you're now talking about the largest political demographic there is, the bottom 90%. they're all going to be interested in what we have to say if we express an interest in solving that problem. And no matter how low of an information voter somebody is, everybody understands one thing, and that is their own personal prosperity. So it's not like you have to go to a low information voter and convince them about our policy for taxes or regulation or anything else. You just have to go to them and say, look, I'm outraged that income for the bottom 90% is flat for the last 40 years, and I'm going to do something about it. And then use that as the frame or the lens to deal with every other problem. Once we fix this problem at the Federal Reserve, where we reform, it basically would involve reforming their mandate, giving them a single mandate to stabilize the dollar, which would prevent them from treating wage growth as inflation. As it stands now, and as it has been for the last 40 years, anytime the economy grows, the Fed stands back, and the point at which they start raising interest rates is the point at which wages for the bottom 90% of the country start to go up. And if they go up too much, the Fed thinks that's inflation, they start raising interest rates, and they stamp out the economic recovery. It happened when Reagan cut taxes. As soon as the tax cuts were fully implemented, they worked. Bottom 90% was the most prosperous they've been in since the 1960s. And by 1988, the Fed stamped it out because wages were going up. It took us into a recession. Then you fast forward to the 90s. You had the Clinton working with House Republicans, came up with a tax cut package, spending restraint. Economy took off. Income for the bottom 90% went up 14%. And the Fed said that's enough. They had six consecutive rate hikes and choked that one off. And then you had, fast forward another decade, you had the Bush tax cuts, which were enacted in 2003. Between 2003 and 2007, it's the only prosperity that the bottom 90% has seen in the last 14 years. And the Fed stamped that out with 17 consecutive rate hikes. So you look back and say tax cuts did exactly what they were supposed to do. It generated economic growth that the bottom 90% participated in, but it was the Fed that stamped it out when income for the bottom 90% went up too much. And that's why you have flat income for so much of the country. If you have flat income for the bottom 90% for another 10 years, what do you think the country is going to be like? So the way to solve any of the problems is to say, first, let's deliver income to the bottom 90%, and then take an issue. Let's take immigration. Let's say, okay, now I want to solve immigration, but I want to do it in a way that's not going to hurt the income of the bottom 90%. Then you go to them and say, I want to repeal Obamacare, because that's a threat to the income growth of the bottom 90%. And if you acknowledge that this is the problem and you have a solution to fix it and you're generating income growth for the bottom 90%, everybody is going to understand that that you're tuned in with them, and you'll have a mandate so strong you can do what you want
to
do.
Well, and I have to agree 100%, Rich. And, this is – We have a lot of issues that candidates run on, and a lot of times they run a little bit from the economics, and it's really, really easy. I do want to take a couple of seconds to throw in your website and your Twitter and your Facebook. Folks, put growth first, PUTGROWTHFIRST, putgrowthfirst.com. While you're there, log in with your Facebook and Twitter. It is a nation builder site. You can join the team, help share the information. There are are some incredible videos there that Rich has put out with some help of some incredibly talented people that will explain this and help explain it. Get these videos. There's especially there's one of them on there, Rich, and you'll have to tell me which one it's called. You know which one I'm talking about. That really, if you've got a candidate that you're supporting for Congress or Senate or even in some of the state elections, get them those videos. Let them see some of these basics. Also, you can go to Put Growth First on Facebook, Put Growth First on Twitter, and help Rich share. You know, that's what we do here. We help get the information out. Rodney and I are both acquainted with Rich Lowry because of a man named Herman Cain. And Herman Cain said when he backed out of that election, he said, go local and start getting the information out and keep doing what you've been doing for me. You just keep continuing and doing it. And that's what we're doing. So go to his website, go to his Facebook, go to his Twitter, help retweet, put him on your notifications so when he throws something up there, you can send it out and get the message out because it is important. And you know, Rich, I also want to talk. We've talked about a couple of different parts. We've talked about the income inequality, which is, you know, I've always said if you really want to make a comparison, you need to compare the poor in this country to the poor in other countries because we're so blessed. But another aspect of this is our tax code. And our tax code is designed, and you, of course, were the author and the writer of 999, which was one way of solving the issue. But our tax code is 80,000 pages, and it's done that way on purpose. It's non-transparent. And Congress can sit up there writing their laws, and they can tweak, like we were talking about the mixing board, they can tweak this little dial here, they can tweak this little dial there, and nobody knows what's going on with it. And we've got some other problems with the tax code. It's lopsided in many ways. We could talk for 5 hours on the problems with the tax code. But how do we fix it, Rich? What do we do? What kind of a thing do we apply? And not only that, something that we can actually accomplish with Washington, D.C. the way it is, to fix that thing so we can have that great big marshmallow burning party I've been wanting to do and burn that 80,000-page tax code.
Well, I think, first of all, it's much more important to fix the monetary system for reasons that we just covered. If you gave us the most perfect, ideal tax code and implemented it tomorrow, I can tell you exactly what's going to happen. You'll get about 4 years of good economic growth, but as soon as income for the bottom 90% starts going up, the Fed's going to stamp it out with rate hikes, and then we're going to go on 50 years a stagnant income for the bottom 90. The left will say, we did exactly what you crazy right-wingers wanted to do. We cut taxes, and look, it just benefited the rich. The average guy is still stagnant for another decade. Because of the Fed, they're the ones that give some semblance of credibility to the notion that tax cuts have benefited the rich. That has nothing to do with the tax cuts. It has everything to do with the Fed. They lower rates early in the cycle, which helps capital income, and it boosts the incomes of people whose income is tied to corporate profits or stock market. And then they sit back, and when growth reaches basically the rest of the population, they choke it off. So the way to make tax cuts work is to fix the Feds. Take away the ability for them to treat wage growth as inflation. You do that with a single mandate to stabilize the dollar where they can't pay attention to wages. Then, when you cut taxes, everybody will participate, and now all of a sudden you have a demand for more tax cuts because everybody's participating in it. And then once you have that in your favor and the average person is feeling that their personal prosperity is on the rise, they're going to be on our side saying, I want more of that. The reason they oppose tax cuts is they don't feel like they've participated in it. You know, right when the benefits of economic growth are filtering down into every corner of society, that's when the Fed chokes it off. And right when the, you know, average worker is about to get a nice raise, that's when the Fed starts raising interest rates to cool the economy off, and that produces a slowdown. It produces layoffs. And when people are getting laid off, the people that still have their jobs aren't getting raises. So I would fix the monetary system first, and then the way I would attack the tax code is I would first lay out the objectives and try to win the discussion on the objectives, because I think that's what most people can relate to. If you say, should we tax workers and shareholders the same way? I think most people would say yes. Should we tax exports, our U.S. exports, on a level playing field with world goods, or should we continue to tilt the playing field against our own interests? And I think most people would agree with that. Should we have imports come in and be taxed on a level playing field with domestic goods, or should we continue to give them a free ride? And I think most people would agree with that. If you can get these, a frame put in place, a framework, where you have a basic understanding where most people agree that that's what a tax code should look like, then I think it's easier to fill in the details. But if you try to engage the public on, you know, the specifics, I think that's where Washington gets bogged down. I mean, I give Chairman Dave Camp a lot of credit for trying to tackle tax reform in this session. But when you downloaded the report, they had about 8 pages of table of contents where it just said, this is repealed, and this is repealed, and this is repealed. And I think the average person is looking at that, and they think, gosh, I'm getting all this stuff taken away. What are we really getting out of it? And it just gets into the weeds too much. So I think if you keep it on a high level and just say, let's just agree that we should have everybody on the same side of the rope pulling together. There shouldn't be any reason to have a separate payroll tax and an income tax. Let's just have one system. So instead of a tug of war against each other, we're all on the same side of the rope pulling for low rates. Let's get small business taxed the same way you tax corporations. Why should the biggest corporations have their own special tax code and have small business pay under the personal return? Let's just have one integrated system that's neutral. And I think everybody would look at that and say, I'm in favor of that. And then you fill in the details, and I think it's a lot easier to sell.
That is a really the concept of everybody jumping on board, though, Rich. I mean, in today's political climate, how do we – I mean, this is getting away from economics, but, you know, you're in the ring. You're not just economic guy. You're a campaign guy. You're a politics guy. You're Washington, D.C. guy. You know, in today's climate, how do you push a movement that people from both sides of the spectrum want to get on? I know that's kind of a nebulous question.
Well,
but
no, I think it's actually pretty simple. First of all, I happen to not buy into the notion of the low-information voter. Granted, there are low-information voters in every market. But a political market where 120 million people cast a ballot is a pretty broad, deep, sophisticated market, just like any other market. So if you're a believer in the wisdom of markets, you have to look at the electorate and say the electorate gets it right all the time. It's up to us to interpret what they want. And if we didn't give them what they want, it's up to us to retool. And I go back to the fact that, you know, income for the bottom 90% of the country has been flat for 40 years. So they're wandering the desert, thirsty and hungry. And does it really make sense for one of us to show up and say, you're low information, read this? The solution is to say, I understand that your income's flat for 40 years and I'm going to do something about it. As soon as we end the silence and acknowledge that's the problem and pledge to deliver a solution and then deliver a solution, then you're going to be able to get both sides together, because now everybody is going to want more personal prosperity. The reason things are so divided right now is that the Republicans don't stand for a legitimate pro-growth agenda. And when the choice is redistribution or austerity, the people are going to prefer redistribution. I mean, this was the most winnable election that I can think of. And we led with austerity, so we lost it.
And until someone comes up with a credible growth agenda, things are going to stay, and for good reason. If those are the only two options, we should have gridlock. We should have inaction. But as soon as someone comes up with a genuine growth agenda, then I think all of a sudden you get bipartisanship because everybody wants growth.
You know, a lot of groups that I've been talking to and a lot of individuals that I've been talking to over the last 5 years or so, in terms of Republican, conservative, libertarian, if I can throw them all into one pot just for a moment, and I'll throw independents in there too, whatever that means. The group that fascinates me the most is the so-called millennials. They're not young kids, and they're not old farts like me. They are, you know, in the age range of, I want to just say, I know this is not technically a millennial, but let's just say the group I'm talking about is between the age of 27, 28-ish, up to 33, 34, you know, maybe even 35, but, you know, right in that area.
Right.
And if that person displays a fairly hardcore streak of conservatism, or what we used to call republicanism, I can almost guarantee you that along with that comes a very strong streak of libertarianism, because they're tired of it. They are
right.
The one thing they all got in common is, you know what? Leave me alone. Quit with the gay marriage, quit with the social stuff, and you know what? I'm tired of people getting bailed out, and I'm tired of, you know, being told one thing and then getting another thing. And how, you know, how, what's your approach on that attitude?
You know, I think that, first of all, the left sells a tangible product. And when you sell a tangible product like benefits, you can say, here's what we have to offer and here's why you should buy it. The people can make an informed decision. We sell an intangible, freedom, opportunity, prosperity. And when you sell an intangible, you can't sell it the same way. You have to know something about what's important to the person, like doctors, lawyers, financial advisors sell intangible products. When was the last time you got a cold call from a doctor saying, hey, I got this knee replacement I want to sell you? You know, the approach for selling an intangible is, you know, what's important to you, and if I know that, I can deliver a solution. So applying that to politics, it means you have to lead with the benefits, not the features. So you don't approach a millennial like that and say, hey, we should cut the corporate tax rate because we're the highest corporate tax rate, blah, 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 blah. That's leading with the features. They may not be able to translate that into what that means for them personally. So you lead with the benefits. And you say, you know, when your income goes up, is that prosperity or is that inflation? And if they agree that that's prosperity, then you have common ground, because you can point to the Federal Reserve and say the powers that be think that when your income goes up, that's inflation, and that's the point at which they start raising interest rates. And if you want to know why income for the bottom 90% of the country is flat for 40 years, that's why. So, you know, if the burden is on us to find common ground first, to me it's best to stick with one thing that we know everybody agrees on, and that's their own personal prosperity. And then I would approach it from there. Once you find common ground, then you can kind of work to expand it.
Is the Republican Party to be trusted? And the reason I say that is because you have a guy like Eric Cantor who woke up one day and he wasn't in Congress anymore, and it was literally that big of a surprise to him. It seemed like. And the reason was not because of, this is my opinion here, the reason is not because of immigration or because Democrats came in and voted in that primary or anything else. And it certainly was not because of Tea Party groups. In a wholesale fashion, ignored David Brat, didn't even return his phone calls.
Right.
It was because the people looked out at Eric Cantor and went, what is this guy? What is he? Not who
right.
is he, what is he? Is he a microcosm? Is he a snapshot of the Republican establishment, or was that just a fluke?
Well, I think he's probably the microcosm of the establishment. But I get the sense that, you know, the more time I spend, on trips to Washington, the more that the Republican Party is not this homogeneous group any more than the Tea Party is. You know, there's a lot of fragmentation to the Tea Party. I think there's a lot of fragmentation to, you know, House Republicans. You have some real superstars that are, guys like Jim Jordan from Ohio, guys like Jim Henseling down in Texas, Mick Mulvaney in South Carolina. I could go on, but I see the best DNA in the House now than we've ever had. There's no other Congress that has this many good Republicans in it. It's not that long that Congress was full of guys like Bob Dole, you know, who never met a tax he didn't hike. So, there are guys that are still, you know, establishment, go along to get along, that, you know, are there because, you know, their career ambition is to be a politician. But by the same token, there are more good guys there than I think we ever have. And I think that's, a hopeful sign for us. If we can rally behind these guys, then we'll get somewhere.
I have a grand theory that history is going to repeat itself. And I'm not saying this will necessarily be bad. It might be great. We'll see. But I was intimately involved with the Contract with America in the early to mid-90s. And I was very powerful in my own way during that period. And it was an unbelievable time in this country's history. It was one of the biggest sweeps of power ever.
Oh, absolutely.
And nobody could have ever. I mean, there wasn't anybody calling that election.
Yeah.
Dan Rostenkowski was swept out of Cook County. I mean, you realize how many actual live votes you had to have to beat him? I mean, he had hundreds of thousands of dead people voting for him. And who was the grand recipient? Who was the real winner in 1994? I will tell you, Bill Clinton. To this day, he reaps the hundreds of millions of dollars in his pocket that the Contract for America gave to him, because he got a Republican Congress that forced him to do the right thing.
Yep.
And I think that in 2014, there's going to be a Republican Senate, and as you say, we have a terrific growing conservative House of Representatives that I think will get deeper and bigger, and Eric Cantor's gone, and there's others that are going to follow. And I think Hillary Clinton is going to become president, and you are going to see her take credit for the economy turning around, when in fact it'll be people like Rich Lowry and like-minded people that turn this country around. What do you think about that crazy theory?
Well, I agree that Bill Clinton was a big beneficiary, but let's give him credit for not vetoing something, that wasn't his stuff. He had a certain political sense where he saw, you know, which way the direction was going, and he went along with it. I think the other big assist that he had to go along with the Contract with America at the Fed, you had Wayne Angel, who in my opinion is the best Fed governor we've ever had, and his approach to managing the Fed was what we need to go back to, which is focus on stabilizing the dollar. That's what Wayne Angel did when he was at the Fed. That kind of approach was still being followed during the Clinton years, which is why you had such strong growth then and why it was allowed to go on so long before the Fed stamped it out. A couple of years after him leaving the Fed board is when the Keynesians took over and said, oh, my God, look at what wages are doing. And they call it, you know, rising unit labor costs, wage pressures. They have all these code words for it. And then they stamped out, you know, that recovery. You know, this time around it could be the same way. I just don't know. I'm not as optimistic that Hillary knows how to pivot for political purposes. I think her ideology is as, you know, deeply rooted as Obama's. You know, I just don't see it. But 16 is a long ways off, and if we do take the Senate and we're able to get the Fed reformed first, then anything we do to generate growth is going to be felt by everybody. If we get that reversed and we do something on regulations, we do something on taxes, we do things to generate growth, it will benefit the economy, but same thing will happen. As soon as the bottom 90% or as soon as the middle of the country starts to feel prosperous, the Fed will start raising rates, and then we'll continue to fight these charges. If the policies we do only help the top, they don't help the bottom. And it, frankly, has absolutely nothing to do with our policies. It has everything to do with the Fed. So if we get that right, then we can go into 2016 claiming credit for delivering robust income growth to the bottom 90%. And then I think 2016 is ours to lose.
Well, when I look out on the contenders for 2016, and I don't think it's too soon to start speculating. Hell, I love speculating about the next president. I start right at the last election ends. I start on the next one. And when I see candidates like Jeb Bush, and I see candidates like, you know, Mitt Romney, they're throwing Mitt Romney's name around again, and I say, you know what? Why can't we have the genuine article just once? Just once. Can't they throw a guy up there that I can really get behind? Why can't I have my Ted Cruz moment? Why is that, Rich?
Boy, I wish I had an answer to that. I can only say that, you know, if you're going to get a lot of the, you know, kind of traditional establishment types, then, you know, I think five or six are better than one. You know, that way they can split the establishment vote up and, you know, give a chance for a real conservative to, you know, come out on top. But it should shape up to be a pretty interesting, you know, field. If you just go down the dozen or so names of people that, you know, are on everybody's short list, or at least who seems to be acting as though they're preparing for a run, you know, I think it'd be a pretty interesting race.
I don't know if you saw the other day, Ted Cruz was sitting in the Senate talking about a bill that 42 Democrat senators had voted on, signed on to. And this bill was basically, in a nutshell, it was repealing a vast portion of the First Amendment. And it was allowing, it would allow Congress to decide political speech. And it was, I was sitting there listening to it, and I was thinking, you know, if this was anybody else but Ted Cruz speaking, I would think they're just filling me full of bullshit, you know, because it just sounded so extreme, this bill. And then I went and read it, and I went, you know what? If that bill were to pass, and I don't think it could pass in a million years, but who knows? I wouldn't think Obamacare could pass either, and it
right.
did. If that bill were to pass, free speech is over as we know it, and Ted Cruz is sitting there going through it paragraph by paragraph and explaining it in no uncertain terms, using the most eloquent layman's language and yet dipping into deep understanding of constitutional knowledge. And I'm just sitting there watching this, and the thing, it's like an 18-minute speech. And I'm sitting there watching this go, why can't this guy be running the joint? And I'm just so, it's so frustrating, Rich. And I don't, and it's not like, and I agree with you on this low information voter thing. I hate that phrase. That's a Rush Limbaugh thing. And I just detest it. And I think it is just another way that people look at Republicans and they go, yeah, that's your problem, looking down your nose at everybody. And I don't
right.
do that. It's right. BS to do that. And Ted Cruz doesn't do that. I really don't think
right.
he does. And I as I often do, and Scott will vouch for this, I've ranted so much that I completely forgot my question. So, Scott, could you get in here and relieve me? Scott is like a relief pitcher. You know,
it's a great conversation.
Have I quoted scripture yet, Scott, in my bumbling?
You know what? I haven't noticed you quoting scripture yet, but I'm sure you will get there before the night is over. And,
right.
and you know, well, I mean, I'm going to disagree with you, though. I don't think Hillary's going to run. I don't think Hillary's been planning on running for 4 or 5 years now. I think, actually, what she's doing right now is doing everything she can do to use the concept of her running to raise money. I got a list of reasons why I don't think she's running. I think health reasons, I think age, and I think she just is tired and ready to settle down and enjoy her later years, plus just some of the people that are around her who have said she's not really running. But I'll tell you something about Ted Cruz here in Texas. Ted Cruz doesn't just stir up the conservative base. He stirs up the moderate base as well, and he also stirs up the libertarians. The libertarians in Texas love him. They love him for the fight. And in fact, Rodney, the reason most of them give for that love of Ted Cruz is what you were talking about. This is the guy that will get up there and fight. This is the guy that will get in there and do it right. He sounds like that. He's very Reagan-esque. Now, I myself would love to run Ted's father as president. I'm a big Rafael Cruz fan. They can both stand on a stage and lay it out in a way that everybody can absolutely understand. But that's my 2 cents worth in on that. And then, of course, part of my job, one more time, put growthfirst.com, You can find Rich's Facebook there. You can find his Twitter there. And log in with your Facebook. And if you have Twitter, log in with both, actually. It's a news builder site. It'll keep track of what you're doing, help build Rich's database so they can get the information out to you. And go to those videos and share them. Get that information out. That's how we win this. This is the point in the evening, Rodney, where I stand here and talk about these houses that sit behind me. And I know that as I look at the neighborhood and look at these houses behind me, if I walked into 100 of those houses, I know that about 80% of the people that I talk to, if we talked about basic conservative principles, smaller government, such as that, I know that about 80% of them would agree with me. But if I walk into those same houses and ask them what's Benghazi, they might try and tell me it was some kind of Italian food. Most people anymore, a lot of people in our country, don't pay attention to current events. They don't pay attention to politics. They don't watch the news. They come home from TV, from work, and they watch a sitcom or they watch a serial on television. And maybe they get a little bit around the water cooler at work, but really don't form a lot of opinions. It's our job, and that's one of the reasons why this is Con Over You, is to help you, the listener, get out and take the information and get it out. When you're standing in the grocery store, you're standing in the line of the grocery store, find a magazine, find something on there that you can bring up to the person standing behind you, start a discussion of politics, and talk about income inequality. Talk about some of these things that we talk about. And your neighbors next door, don't be afraid to talk to them. We've been told over and over and over again for decades, two things you don't talk about, politics and religion, and the other two things we should be talking about most is politics and religion. So it's about getting the message out. It's about getting the word out. And with that, Rodney, I'll pass it back to you because you and Rich are having an incredible conversation, and I'm loving listening to it.
Scott,
hey,
I would
Rich,
just add to that.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead, Scott, I would just add to that, as a conversation starter, ask somebody, when your income goes up, is that prosperity or inflation?
Well, yeah.
And see how they react to that. Because that's the
question. I don't
think you'd
get too many people calling it inflation, would they?
Well, in Washington you do. And I think that's the question that we need to bring up. It's so simple, but it's so profound. It's a question that has – it's the discussion
that in the national political narrative hasn't happened yet. And because it hasn't happened, we're stuck in this stagnation for the bottom 90% of the country for 40 years. And that stagnation is what's giving us all these other problems. Because of the stagnation, we voted for Obama.
Well, if I was a conspiracy freak, and I'm not, just ask the people that are hiding behind the bushes in my backyard. I'm not a conspiracy freak. However, when you say things like what's been going on for the last 40 years and why, can't we audit the Fed? And the Federal Reserve is not part of the government. In fact, they are a privately owned entity, are they not? They're separate from the government. They're autonomous.
This goes back to my point. We sell an intangible, so we have to lead with the benefit, not the features. If you try to start a conversation by saying the Fed is owned by the member banks or anything like that, it gets into the weeds so fast. If you want to, clear people out of a room, just start a conversation about monetary policy. It'll work every time. Turn it around and say, when your income goes up, is that good or bad? Because you know the people in power think that's bad.
Right.
And if you want to do something about that, join with us. Support the Centennial Monetary Commission so that we can reform the Fed. That's a way to get the whole country behind reforming the Fed. If you go out and say, hey, we ought to just end the Fed, that's not a solution.
Right.
That slogan will catch on with a small segment of the population, but it won't go anywhere. And if you say, well, QE is good or bad, or you start talking about the technical stuff, then that just gets dragged into the weeds so fast that it just grinds to a halt. And think about this. The proving grounds, the resume builders for most of the people we send to Washington are at the states. Most people hold a job at a state level as a state rep or a statewide office. Then they go to Washington. What's the only policy area that they get no exposure to at the state? Monetary policy. They deal with budgets and regulation and taxes and everything else that you deal with in Washington. They deal with it at the state level, but they don't deal with monetary policy. So they run their first campaign. It's about everything but monetary policy because they have no experience with that. They go to Washington. They have a resume. They have a track record. They have a voting record. But on the most important issue that the country is facing, they have zero exposure. And then as soon as you start a conversation about it with them, it gets dragged into the weeds, so they avoid it. And the solution isn't to approach it on the technical basis, but to do it on the benefit side. When your income goes up, is it good or bad? If it's good, join with us. We're the good guys. We're going to fix this. And now you have a mandate to fix the Federal Reserve that you'll never get if you try to approach it the other way.
Well, I agree 100%. And Rich, we want to take this a little different direction here for a few minutes, because we generally start out a show and we talk about give a little bit of biography and talk about how you got where you're at. But I want to throw in here a big, huge congratulations to you. Rich Lowry just got married. What was it? 2 weekends ago, and we're so glad that you've enjoyed your time. You had a great wedding. I saw some pictures. The great Herman Cain officiating at a beautiful wedding. And we just have to ask, Rich, your new wife, is she a liberal or is she conservative?
Well, when we first started dating, I had to get some knockout factors out of the way. And I think the first question, we got introduced through a mutual friend and, early on kind of communicated back and forth on the phone and email. And one of the first questions I asked was, she's from Pennsylvania. So I had to find out if she a Steelers fan, because I'm a Browns fan, and that would have been a knockout factor if she was a Steelers fan. And I think the second question I asked her, what are your political beliefs? And she said, well, you go to school, you get a job, you be responsible for yourself. And I thought, okay, we're going to get along just fine.
Exactly. And, you know, and of course, we've seen some Mary Matlin. We've seen some people that have been conservative married to diehard liberals in the past, and they seem to get along great. But we jokingly, of course, but we want a big congratulations to you for that. That's wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Wish you many, many years of happiness. Like I say, I saw pictures. She's beautiful. Wonderful thing to have V. Herman Cain officiating for you. And I hope you had a great time traveling and enjoying that time. Rich, I'd like
you
to just kind of go in a little bit of your biography of what you've done in the past and some of the things and how you got to where you're at right now. Because you're in a position right now where you can affect some great, great change, especially as we get candidates listening to what you're saying and get them just sharing their message out on the campaign field. You can make a lot of difference. What is the path that brought you here?
Well, it's been kind of a long path. Probably started about maybe 14 years ago. And I just decided I was going to set aside a certain amount of time in my schedule each week to try to have some kind of impact in the community. And I started getting involved locally. And the first, volunteer thing I did, I went to a soup kitchen and quickly learned that my technique was no different or better than the guy next to me, and I wasn't really adding any value. So I put some thought into, what am I going to do, with this time set aside? And as soon as you start volunteering your time, you get enormous demands on it. You know, everybody wants free labor. So that kind of forced me to really prioritize. And that process kind of evolved into, I think I know something about how the economy works. I think I can explain it to the average person. And let me look for opportunities where I can do more of that. And just, one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. Got involved with Americans for Prosperity at the state level in Ohio. We tried to get a tax reform measure put on the ballot. In doing that, I met people who were involved with AFP that later became involved with Herman Cain. Got a call from Mark Block, who was Cain's campaign manager, and a friend of mine saying, "You're not going to believe this, but Cain's going to run for president, and I'm going to be his chief of staff." And he and I just kind of stayed in touch. This was 2010, a year before Cain ran. And Mark would call me from time to time, and, he might get a question from somebody in the audience, and he, would call me and ask about it, or he would say, Cain is talking about repatriated profits, and I don't know what those are, but he gets applause, walk me through what that is. And, that went on kind of on a casual basis, on and off for a year, and then that led to an opportunity to interview for economic advisor for Cain. And obviously that was an opportunity that's opened doors since, and has given me an opportunity to do what I'm doing with Put Growth First now. And Put Growth First will work with grassroots groups, campaigns, candidates, and office holders. And it's just a matter of saying, how do you take pro-growth policies, which are really what's going to solve our problems? Economic growth is the problem. Lack of economic growth is the problem. How do you get back to economic growth to solve the problems? And how do you explain it to the average person so that you can improve your effectiveness? Growth does the most to solve the most problems, it does so at the least cost, and it does so in a way that unites the country.
Well, exactly.
Rich, when you first came on with the Herman Cain campaign for president, what struck you the most about, at the time it was a very grassroots type of organization. It was a very, I don't mean this to sound negative because, I was there myself there was nothing negative about it for me, but it was a little bit disorganized. It was a little bit catch-as-catch-can, and it was a little bit of running around here and running around there, and it just seemed to kind of coalesce at some point. And now, what were your impressions in the early rounds of that campaign? Was it as exciting for you as it was for me, or are you one of these Beltway insiders that it's just like, well, here's another guy running for office. Whatever.
Oh, no. No, it was a great experience. It was the first presidential campaign that I've been involved with. And to be involved not only in the first campaign, but at, you know, senior level like that was an amazing experience. And I think the campaign had the right strategy all along, and that they would go after the grassroots and say, the hell with the establishment, we're not going to listen to them. And, you know, that worked. They had everything kind of mapped out where Cain would kind of break on the scene in Iowa at the first primary in January. And I think that to the extent that, anyone would say the campaign was, you know, disorganized or, you know, things like that, you know, Cain broke to the top too early, you know, too early according to the plans, and they just couldn't gear up fast enough to kind of keep up with, you know, the demand. And, you know, the growth phase that they went through from, you know, August to November was enormous. And that would be difficult for anybody to manage. So, you know, all in all, it was a great experience. I think that, you know, it kind of shows you the appetite that the country has for, you know, somebody who brings different experience to the table. You know, they used to criticize Cain for not having experience. It's like, wait a second, experience you want him to have. If you want him to have executive experience running large organizations, he has as good or better than anybody on the stage. But if you want him to have experience pandering as a politician, no, he doesn't have that kind of experience. But I think it shows the thirst that the country has for somebody who's willing to embrace big ideas, bold change, you know, not represent the status quo. And, you know, it certainly is going to make 2016 interesting to see kind of who steps up and fills that void.
Yeah, I had a really thrilling experience there with Mr. Cain. I've never had a real presidential contender, or in this case, he was a presidential contender in that he was a contender for the Republican nomination. And I've never had somebody like that ask me my opinion about something and then take my advice. That's never happened to me.
Yeah.
25 years of political activism, and that was thrilling, you know, to have somebody right before a debate say, well, what do you think I should say? Well, and then I'm sitting there going, I've been thinking about that question for 25 years, and I was just like, you're really asking me that? And I said, why don't you go out there and tell them all to lighten up? And he did. And it was quoted a million times on television.
I know. I remember
I've never gotten over that. I've just never recovered from that experience. And it was, like you're saying, people were hungering, you know, for that kind of thing. And because it was just like, hey, America needs to lighten up. And it was the truth. It was just what everybody's been thinking. And here's a guy, you know, if Newt Gingrich, bless his heart, nothing against Newt, but if Newt Gingrich were to say America needs to lighten up, they would baste him. I mean, it's just not right coming out of his mouth. And I don't mean to pick on Newt. I mean, it wouldn't be right coming out of most people's mouth. But it was really great in that respect. And, boy, I don't know who is the Herman Cain of 2016. I really don't. I don't see anybody. I mean, in terms of conservatism, yes, but I just mean coupled with the personality and the private world experience, I don't know who that would be. Do you have a couple of favorites when you talk about contenders?
You know, not offhand. I've met with a few of them. You know, we're trying to walk them through what we're doing with Put Growth First. To me, the front runner is going to be the guy who understands income for the bottom 90% is stagnant for 40 years and pledges to fix it. That will overcome what someone might not have in terms of, you know, charisma, or that might overcome what someone doesn't have with, you know, other
traits that you might look at in a candidate. The first person who's on board with that is going to be the one that taps into 90% of the country and pledges to solve their number one issue. And I think that's an unbeatable, political dynamic. And it's as simple as going back to the question I mentioned earlier, when your income goes up, is that inflation or prosperity? If you take that message, that approach, and you give that to a Ted Cruz and combine that with all his other good qualities, that's going to be really hard to beat. If it's Marco Rubio, who kind of owns that narrative, there's a lot of guys that if you put it together with the right message and the right narrative, that would be one heck of a candidate. Take a Scott Walker, somebody who's accomplished an awful lot in Wisconsin, and talk about somebody who is a fighter and who has a backbone. Maybe he's looking for something that will help him, stand out from the crowd, since, his name isn't in the limelight, as much. Who knows? So we'd be interested. We've met with a handful of them. We'd be interested in meeting with all of them. And our desire would be to have every candidate accept us. I mean, just like every candidate would be united in their opposition to Obamacare, our desire is that everyone on our side should be united in recognizing the problem of stagnant income and pledging to fix it.
How much of this, you talk about the chairman of the Fed, the Federal Reserve through its chairman, tamping down wages in the name of trying to control inflation on various times over the last 30 years after these three big tax cuts, the Reagan, the Clinton, the Bush, after these tax cuts have worked brilliantly, and they always work. And
all the supply-side tax cuts work.
Exactly.
All the demand side cuts never work. So like the Bush cuts in 2001 and 2008 never have, never will work. It's the supply side tax cuts that always work.
Right, and they worked. And then, as you say, the Federal Reserve, through its chairman, tamped down, they said they're tamping down, raising interest rates in the name of tamping down inflation, and all they really do is tamp down wages. Now, how much of that is the fact that there's more than a handful of people in this country that don't want wages to go up, and that same group of people are also behind the push for amnesty? I mean, illegal labor isn't just cheap, Rich. It also suppresses all wages across the board. Even the threat of illegal labor suppresses wages. So how much of it is that?
Well, I do think that has something to do with it. Trying to give people the benefit of the doubt, there aren't many people in the workforce today that were around from 48 to 71 when the Fed had a mandate to stabilize the dollar. If commodity prices went up, namely gold, they drained liquidity. So they went back down. If gold prices and commodity prices went down, they added liquidity to get it back up. And what that meant for business is two things. Stable input costs. So your raw material costs for businesses were stable. If you go back and look at oil prices over that stretch of time, it was like a flat line. And to go along with stable input costs, you had a stable unit of measure, a stable dollar. So now you can invest more because you have the confidence that you're not going to be incredibly wrong in the future value of the dollar. So when you make a big investment as a business, where you take liquid cash and you convert it into a factory that's illiquid, you better be right about the cash flow that factory is going to produce. And the one thing that can destroy that is if the value of the dollar changes. So back then, businesses had the ability, through stable input costs and a stable unit of measure, to invest so that productivity kept pace with wages. Since then, in 71, the Fed has done the opposite. Instead of stabilizing commodity prices and input prices and allowing wages to rise, they've done it the opposite. They let food and energy prices rise, they let commodity prices rise, and then they try to, you know, clamp down on wages. And that's because the definition of inflation changed. It no longer is a decline in the value of the dollar. It's now an increase in some index, the PCE deflator or the CPI. And because the index is a lagging indicator, the guys at the Fed, the academics at the Fed say, the index that we're trying to control is a lagging indicator, but we have to make real-time decisions today. So what do? You can't track the PCE deflator, the CPI, real-time. So they look at things that they think are leading indicators of that index. And if you deconstruct the index, you're going to come up with material costs, labor costs, and capital costs. And they've opted to clamp down on labor costs. And, you know, so what that means for businesses, there are a lot of big businesses that don't mind it when the Fed raises rates to cool off labor costs. In fact, if you go read some of the transcripts of past Fed meetings, you know, you have the guys who sit on the Fed board that represent big business. And the things they talk about are wage pressures, you know, tight labor markets. And, you know, I think that you're not going to get the support from them to change the policy. But if you present it as a package and say, look, this reform is going to result in stable input costs for you and a stable unit of measure, stable dollar, so that you can invest more and you can invest more successfully so that when we allow wages to go up, you have the ability to invest so that your productivity keeps pace with wages. I mean, back in the day, if a CEO complained about wage costs going up, the attitude was, that's what you get paid the big bucks to do. We're giving you stable input costs and a stable unit of measure, and as a CEO, you get paid the big bucks to figure out how to invest in your business so that your productivity rises along with wage growth. Nobody sat back and said, well, it's about time for the Fed to start raising rates because labor markets are getting tight and, you know, do you see what I have to pay a new secretary lately? But I'm sure that stuff goes on now.
Well, exactly. And we want to thank you. I know it's getting late there where you're at, Rich. We don't want to keep you up past midnight. And we know you got a brand new beautiful bride to go to. It's been a great discussion. Like I say, Rich, I always enjoy having discussions with you. We've had a few on the phone. We've had you on, I think this is about the third time I've had you on one of our shows. Economics is not a difficult issue. It's not a difficult subject, but sometimes we make it difficult. And you are doing a very good job of making it very, very simple and clear to understand with Put Growth First. And I want to encourage everybody again one more time, putgrowthfirst.com. Go to the website, log in with your Facebook, log in with your Twitter, share the information, get the videos out there, get them to your local congressman, get them to your state house. I think Rich might have to gather up some Texas politicians down here and have you come down here and hold a meeting with them here one of these days soon, because this stuff is really important. Like I say, Rich, though, I always feel when I'm done like I should be getting some college credit at some university for what I've learned, and I've learned a lot tonight, and I hope our listeners have too. And, you know, that's what it's all about. It's all about sharing information. So we want to hugely thank you for coming on and educating our listeners and educating us and having some great discussion.
Well, sounds good. I really appreciate you having me on, and the pleasure is certainly mine.
Hey, thanks a lot, Rick.
It was really great. All right. Take care, buddy.
Take care. See you later. Well, did you learn anything, my friend Scott Osborne? Learn anything new?
You know what? As always, I'm going to have to go and I'm going to have to listen through it again and take notes.
Yeah.
I just always have to with Rich. He's got so much to say. It's so important. You know, and income inequality is like he really alludes to, the problem is the bottom half, the bottom part has stayed stagnant for a long, long time. It stayed stagnant, and it shouldn't be, and it doesn't take a whole lot of effort to change that. But we got a tiger by the tail, and we're gonna make sure we keep talking about Rich Lowry and put growth first.
Well, I can, for people that have been here for the last hour listening to Rich Lowry, some of it does get pretty involved, and I'm thank God I am here to interpret and explain exactly what Rich Lowry was talking about to the masses. And I think I can best sum up the last hour of economic theory and advice, political implementation of that economic theory by Rich Lowry, this way. I don't know what the hell he's talking about. And you know what? You can go to the Conover U archives, and you too can listen again. No, I'm just kidding. I really, really dig the fact that he boils this stuff down to where I can understand it, because it actually makes me think of other wacky theories that I could throw at him next time I talk to him. And I love it when I throw out my wild opinions to him, and instead of going, Rodney, what planet are you living on? He just explains the real deal, and I realize after about 15 seconds what he's saying is, Rodney, what planet are you living on? And so he's very nice about it, you know. But while we were talking, now, as you mentioned, you alluded, we talked about the Herman Cain campaign a while, and that was always fun. And that's where you and I met Rich Lowry, because he was Herman Cain's financial advisor. He invented the 999 tax system, which really, really, you know, whether you understood it or whether you agreed with it or whether you thought it was a good idea or not, man, it was the talk of the town, and it really, really, really got some wheels. It really took off. And if you, I'll tell you, even people that thought it was bad, even people that don't, you know, that were not on board with 999, every one of them said it's better than what we got now. I mean, the worst thing that anybody ever said about 999 was, well, it's better than our existing tax system. So, and of course, the people that loved it, you know, they wanted to get it implemented. But you got to admit, it was a huge, huge success that really kept popping Herman Cain back into the limelight. You know what I'm saying, Scott?
Everybody well, it did, and you know, it was Jack Kemp during the Reagan years had a plan a lot like it called 10-10-10. And, you know, I really like 999, and it took me a little bit of understanding. In fact, it took Rich Lowry, the first time I interviewed him, when he came on Conservatives Coast to Coast to explain 999. And it took me listening about twice and taking some notes, but I learned how to combat the people that didn't like it. But, you know, the real key to 999 was its simplicity. It was its simplicity, and it brought it down in the transparency of the taxes that it brought out, and Herman Cain always said it would be the largest transfer of power from the government back to the people, and I agree with that, and I believe that wholeheartedly. Whether it's 999 or any other simplified tax legislation would do that. I happen to firmly believe in the fair tax, number one, because we've got legislation for it that's already laid out. Now, of course, it would have to go through and have a few tweaks here and there. Legislation always does. But it seems to be the absolute, the fair tax happens to me seems to be the absolute solution to that. But, Ronnie, we've got all kinds of funny things coming on in the news today. And I know
well,
you want to talk a little bit about Hillary.
I want to talk about Hillary, and the reason is because you kind of jumped all over me there and started screaming at me in the middle of the Rich Lowry interview about how Hillary was not going to run and that I was all wet with my theory about Hillary Clinton winning the presidency. And, well, that's not true. You never yell. But you did say that you – I didn't know this. You don't think Hillary
is going to run, and she's just really out there to make money. Well, if that, and I, it occurred to me just now, if Scott Osborne is correct, and you usually are, so I better start paying attention. If you're correct about this, that she has no intentions of running, even though she ran in 2008 and was very serious, then why is, you know, she's out on this book tour. Why did she write a book, Scott Osborne, that is so plain vanilla, that is so milquetoast? Anybody that knows anything about book publishing, and I happen to know a lot about it, will tell you this. You cannot sell a book if it doesn't have something, A, controversial in it, B, if it doesn't have information in it that heretofore has not come out, and C, it has to be wildly interesting. You cannot sell a book without those three things. Her book has not just done, not one of them, it has none of those three things. The only thing it has is a 25-year-old picture of her on the front and a terrible title, Hard Choices. That should be Bill Clinton's book, don't you think? Or maybe one of his girlfriend's books. I don't know, but it shouldn't be her book, Hard Choices. It's terrible. She never made a hard choice in her life. She took the easy choice every time. My word. Why, Scott?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you asked that, because I just had this conversation. I had this conversation yesterday.
Why would you
write a book? And I'll tell you why I think. Go ahead.
I'm just saying, why would she write a book like that if she wasn't? That's the book you write if you're running for president, not if you're not. If you're trying to make money, that ain't the book you write.
See, and I had this conversation yesterday, and it wasn't the book that you would write if you were running for president either. Really not even good for that. I'll tell you why she wrote it like she did. We can say a lot of bad things about the Clintons, but there's a few good things we can say about them, too. They are excellent politicians, and they are team players. And I really don't think that Hillary Clinton wanted to, and I don't think the Obama administration wanted to. I don't think Nancy Pelosi or Harry Reid or Barbara Boxer wanted to stir anything up right now in the situation they're in. Number two, I think it was written exactly the way Hillary portrays herself. I think she just, I really do. I think, and you know, Hillary doesn't have the oomph that it takes on the campaign trail. We've seen that before. We've seen that when she ran her Senate races. What she always won on, and here's, I have to give her another A plus on this. As much as I disagree with her ideologically, and as much as I think that her term in office, her last term in office as a person running around the world working for Barack Obama, the Clintons are both excellent at administration. When she was a senator, she was not down there playing politics. She was out working and working hard. Now, working hard on things that I don't agree with, on positions that I don't agree with, but she did an incredible job. She, over the last few years, rose her approval rating sky high. Now, it has dropped over the last year. It has dropped, like, by 20 points, Benghazi and all these things that I really throw them right back up on the president. I think she was just doing the bidding. I think she saw it that way. And I think she was a fool for doing it. But I really do. I think she wrote the book for who Hillary thinks Hillary is, not what the world really sees Hillary as. And I really think that I don't think she wanted to rock the boat. I don't think she wanted to take the limelight. I don't think she wanted to step up there and do it. I think she thought she could go on that book trail, and she could just talk, and the news media was just going to leave her alone and just ask the softball questions. She wasn't ready for that. They haven't. The media started asking hardball questions, and she wasn't ready for it. But I really, Rodney, I'll tell you why I really don't think Hillary's going to run. There have been so many people that know them well that have said she really doesn't want to, including Bill Clinton. including Larry Nichols, who was very close with them, including Dick Morris, who knows them well. They just don't think she wants to run, and I think she's an incredible money machine. She will be an incredible money machine until the day that she says, I'm not running anymore, and then she'll have to change gears and raise money in other ways. But the Democrats are throwing money at her right and left. But she's also got some huge, huge problems if she goes to run. And this was the problem that she had when she ran against Barack Obama. The far left does not like Hillary. Hillary is a hawk when it comes to foreign affairs, foreign policy. You go out to San Francisco or go down to L.A. and you ask the people how they feel about Hillary Clinton. And most liberal Democrats, they don't really care for her. So I really don't. We'll see what happens here as the months go on. But I think they're going to have to take somebody like a Julian Castro, which I think is going to be the death knell for them, because while Barack Obama was willing to lie, I think the Castro brothers have both been taught to tell the truth and tell exactly who they are and what they believe. And I believe that next campaign, if Julian Castro gets in there, it'll be about what he actually believes and where he wants to go, and I don't think the American public buy it.
Well, I can tell you this. If she is either running for president or just running to make money, things are not going too smooth so far on the old book tour, or as I call it, the sisterhood of the traveling pantsuit. Not going too good so far. Do you know what I'm saying? A lot of gas, a lot of just looks of disbelief on her face. Did you mute your mic? Is that why I hear no laughter from you?
No.
Oh, it's not funny. In this case, man. I don't think I'm going to be quoting any scripture while talking about Hillary, unless it's Revelations. I might get that. But when she goes on this book tour, she handpicks women to interview her. She doesn't allow men to interview her. Now, the other day, she reluctantly allowed Fox News to interview her, Bret Baier, but it had to be with Greta Van Susteren. There had to be a woman there. So it's like this really pathetic situation where she's so controlling. And even with women interviewing her, this woman from NPR asked her about, what was that question they had? Oh, it was about her quote-unquote evolving her evolving stance on gay marriage. Now, she stole that word, the NPR woman stole the word evolving from the Barack Obama campaign. Hillary never said, my position has evolved. But in fact, Hillary, when it was politically expedient, Hillary ran and backed and supported traditional marriage. She supported a federal ban on, not a federal ban, but a federal, what do you call it? Yeah, a ban on gay marriage. In other words, a definition that marriage be between one man and one woman. Hillary very strongly supported that. She ran on that in 2008. Scott, that was only 6 years ago. She ran on traditional marriage, as did our president, as did Joe Biden, and the rest of them. You know, Al Gore used to be pro-life. I mean, it's not evolving. Political expediency, believe me, if it was more, they evolved on nothing. It was campaign cash that got them to switch their minds on gay marriage. Everybody knows that. They would throw gay people under the bus if it was politically expedient. They don't care. Okay, a bunch of people from Arkansas, and believe me, the opinions of people in Arkansas are one man and one woman. I know, I've spent a lot of time there. So she thinks she's walking into this very friendly interview at NPR, and one of the first things this woman says to her, well, you were for traditional marriage. Which is kind of ironic because she can't even keep her own husband in the yard. I mean, who has a more non-traditional marriage than Hillary Clinton. I ask you, Scott Osborne, I mean, how less traditional can you get than that marriage?
Not the truth.
I mean, I don't care. It's not my business. It's their marriage. And if they have an agreement, they have an agreement. I don't think it's healthy, but okay, whatever. I believe that Chelsea Clinton has a world. She is going to see the inside of a therapy office many, many hours the rest of her life for what her parents have done in public to humiliate her. I don't think Chelsea Clinton is going to have a very favorable opinion about men at all. Now, that's pretty harsh, and I probably shouldn't be talking about people's kids, but I'm not talking about people's kids. I'm talking about the Clintons and the choices and the hard choices that they've made. Let me tell you something about Hillary Clinton's hard choices. She made the choice, the hard choice, to stand by while some horny redneck publicly humiliated her daughter. That's a hard choice that Hillary Clinton made. Why? Because Hillary Clinton wanted to be in the game, and it was more important to be in the game than to have a healthy daughter.
Oh, definitely.
And that's
most definitely. And, you know, there's something else that goes along with this, and you know, Hillary fumbles. She had foot and mouth disease the whole time she was in the Senate when she got up to speak a lot of times. And she really doesn't have that something special. I always said Herman Cain had that something special, like Ronald Reagan did, that just made them dynamic. But there's another rail to this whole discussion. And it's the reason why I keep saying, you know, the establishment is going to pick somebody. I keep saying, I hope they pick Jeb Bush. I think Jeb Bush is the easiest to beat, and I think in some ways Hillary Clinton is the easiest to beat, because there is a whole lot. You know, you and I are on one team. We are politically savvy for the most part. We are current events savvy. We're active. We're involved. There are people on the left that are that way. They're activists. They know what's going on in current events. But then you've got middle America. And some of that, the middle America doesn't always know exactly what P's and Q's are on each issue or exactly what's going on every day in current events. But I tell you what they're saying. They're saying we don't want another Bush and we don't want another Clinton. We want something different. And I believe that Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush both walk into a primary with that negative going against them. Now, Mitt Romney, through the primary, held at a steady 40% all the way through. If you go back and you look at the Gallup polls, you look at those polls, he had a very low positive intensity score, but he held on to that 40%, and that was what was just enough to keep him. As time went on, as each candidate fell out, Herman Cain, Rick Perry, Michelle Bachmann, as they fell out, and then Mitt Romney gained a few of those percentage points after each one fell out, and the rest scattered between the rest of the conservatives. Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton, I believe, start out lower than that. And I'm going to talk about Jeb Bush starting lower than 40%. I don't think Jeb Bush starts out as an establishment pick candidate. When you start going through Ohio, when you start going through Iowa, when you start going through New Hampshire, I don't think Jeb Bush pulls the numbers that Mitt Romney pulls. And he's a good guy. I was in Florida when Jeb Bush was governor, and he was a good governor in the state of Florida. We had a good economy going, and I could say some positive things about Jeb Bush. But I don't think he gets the threshold he needs to beat the conservatives as they go forward. Now, if we throw a whole bunch of conservatives in there like we did last time and split the vote, we've got problems. But I don't think he can do as well by a long shot next to Mitt Romney. And I don't think Hillary does the same thing in the Democratic Party. We know that there's going to be some kind of primary. And I just don't – I think that in itself starts her out a whole lot further behind than most people are saying.
You know what? I see what you're saying. You know, it's solid. It's solid theory on your part. And I especially agree that the conservatives will split the grassroots conservative or Tea Party, if you want to say that, vote. You got Rand Paul. You got your governor there from Texas, Perry.
You've got Marco Rubio might be throwing his hat in there. And people don't want to hear this, but you got Chris Christie. I don't care what people say in the press or what people scream at Tea Party rallies. Chris Christie is an independent, Herman Cain-like personality in that he says what he is thinking. And people
right.
will be attracted to that. Now, yeah, oh, okay, well, I don't like his immigration thing. Oh, okay, I don't like his gun thing. I don't like this thing. I don't like that thing. I got news for you. He shows up and starts ripping Obama, and people dig it. People love that Mennonite, and I didn't cuss this time. And let me tell you something else. He's electable. He's electable, my friend. He is electable. Now, he is not my choice, Scott Osborne. Please don't misinterpret. This is the part of the conversation where not Scott, but somebody else would go, oh, you like Christie. No, I don't. He's not my choice, but he is electable. Do you know that he got more votes for governor in New Jersey than any other governor of New Jersey ever? And it's not a red state. It's a blue state. And for the most part, he's a Republican. The vast majority of his positions are solid Republican. And yet, people in New Jersey, red, blue, purple, and everything else voted for him because they dig him. And let me tell you, if it was him versus just about any Democrat for president, whoa to that Democrat, because Chris Christie would roll him. Can you imagine Chris Christie in a debate with Barack Obama? I mean, can you fathom? I'm not, of course, it's not going to happen. Barack Obama won't be there. But can you imagine Chris Christie in that debate instead of Mitt Romney, the one with Iraq?
Oh, you would have tore it up.
The one with Benghazi?
Yeah, he would have tore it up.
Can you imagine if Candy Crowley would have pulled out a transcript to help Barack Obama, what Chris Christie would have done? He would have said,
oh. And all of it.
Wait a minute there, Ms. Crowley. Do I get a look at that transcript? Where did you get that? And what are you two doing behind the scenes before this debate? How come I wasn't in on the little planning session? I mean, he'd have been on them like stink on the night. Anyway.
Well, he would have. And you know, okay. That at that point, and I'll tell you, that's why Chris Christie's the one I don't want them to throw in there. I don't want the established to pick him. I think he could do better in the primary than Mitt Romney could for that reason. But yet he's not exactly who I want in the office. But then again, and I'm going to say this, and I hope every single one of our listeners is listening to this, because this is the problem that we had during the last primary. Whoever does win that primary, we got to jump behind him 100%. Because I'm going to tell you, folks, I there's a lot of disagreements that I have with Chris Christie. But, boy, I sure would much rather have Chris Christie in there than anybody that the Democrats are going to put up by a long shot. And I think I thought Mitt Romney would make a decent president. I think Chris Christie would make a decent president. I believe Jeb Bush would make a decent president. Do I have problems with where they stand, squishy on a lot of issues? Yes, I do, hugely. I hugely disagree with Jeb Bush on Common Core. I don't know exactly where Chris Christie stands on it. But once we get past that primary, folks, we got to lay the swords down. Primary is where you fight for your ideology. You fight as hard as you can for your candidate that stands for what you believe in. When we get to that general elections where you got to put the guns down and everybody stand on the same team, we've got to do that here in Texas. We fought David Dewhurst, I've got real problems with the way he ran his campaign. If he had won, though, I would have had to turn around and support him 100%. And that's where we end up. And boy, and I'll tell you, I have to give it to Chris Christie. He knows how to communicate. He's a communicator, and it's why he's doing so well in New Jersey. Now, of course, New Jersey is the polar opposite of Texas, of course. You got most of your Republicans are liberals instead of being conservatives. But with that, I'll pass it back to you, Rodney.
Well, he's got another thing that people don't give him credit for, but I see it. He's got that – he doesn't have the charm – he doesn't have the –
the southern charm of Bill Clinton, but he has that empathy thing that Bill Clinton has. When he talks, especially when he talks about women's issues, or when he's talking to a woman, or when he's talking to a group of women, or when he's talking about something having to do with women, he gets that empathy going. And I mean, he really connects with women, just like Bill Clinton did. And you and I know that Bill Clinton's full of crap. It's just a seduction technique. And he's a clown. But I don't think Chris Christie is a clown. I think he says what he means and means what he says. And you know what? I disagree with him on immigration. You know, I disagree with him on gun control. But you know what? At least he says the truth about where he stands. I would rather have a guy that I believe is telling the truth that I disagree with than have a guy I agree with that I'm not sure is telling the truth.
Oh, exactly.
And that's how I feel about politicians, because when John Boehner talks, I don't know. I have no idea if he's telling me the truth or not. I don't take anything he says to the bank. Nothing.
You can't trust him.
You know, it's kind of like when you're in business and somebody, you know, and they're waffling on interest rates. They go up, they go down. Look, I don't care if interest rates are 20%. Just tell me what they are and what they're going to be, and then I'll deal with it. Tell me what the rules are, and tell me they're not going to change, and then I will proceed. And that's how I feel about politics. Tell me where you stand, and then don't change your position at the moment of truth, and don't go behind my back and make a deal with somebody, and don't run off to Florida and meet with some jerk from Ohio and raise a bunch of money from labor unions and just be a creep, okay? That's what I like about Chris Christie. Now, Jeb Bush, not only do you not agree with him on Common Core, I don't know how somebody that has been around as long as Jeb Bush is could possibly support Common Core. That is beyond just me disagreeing with him on an issue, Scott. That's me looking at him going, is there something else I should know about you, Jeb Bush? Is there a larger thing here that we should be considering? And combine that with his stance on immigration, he is full-blow amnesty, my friend. Go ahead. I interrupted you.
100%. And I'll tell you, Jeb Bush, anybody who is a conservative and that does not realize that when you turn around and you start passing the control over education from the superintendent level, from the principal level, up to the federal government, and then on to the UN, which is where Common Core is designed to take it. You've either got to be really, really conned, or you have no problem with big, huge government clear at the top, including the UN. And I believe the Bushes, all three of the Bushes kind of have a soft spot in their heart for a more of a one-world control of certain things going on. As a human being, as a man, I think George Bush, our president, both of them were good men. But I think all three of those Bushes, and George P. Bush, who is running for land commissioner, I believe, here in Texas, Jeb's son, they are all squishy on certain issues. And Common Core, Jeb Bush is just flat out wrong. He's either believed the lie that Common Core is just a set of standards, and he's been told all the wrong information, or he fully understands the full scheme and has no problem with it. And either one causes me great grief, because Common Core is not just a set of standards. Common Core is a scheme that includes standards and a whole lot of other legs designed to do so on and so forth. Well, Rodney, we passed up the top of the hour. We're in record mode. Forgot to let the people know they needed to call in if they were going to continue to listen, but we can keep going if you want. I do want to discuss for a couple of seconds this flag issue down here in Houston, Texas. You know, Rodney, How many times would you say over the last 5-6 years have we seen an apartment complex try and tell its tenants that they could not fly the flag?
Well, all you have to do is go to the Drudge Report archives and count how many times he's done a headline on it. That's how many times.
Isn't that the truth? And every time it goes to Matt Drudge, every time 33 million viewers in one day sees the article, every single time the phone starts ringing off the hook, the internet starts, the Facebook page for the apartment complex starts ringing off the hook, their email gets fooled up, they've got reporters beating them down at their office, and within about a day, always, they turn around and go, oh, we made a mistake, we shouldn't have done that. Well, that happened down here in Houston. This morning, when we found out this guy was told he couldn't fly his flag over the edge of his balcony because of this one reason, and this is the reason he was told, it might offend Muslims. Well, we go throughout the day and we find out that there's a small handful of Muslims that do live there, and most of them are also flying United States flags to start off with. But by the end of the day, this apartment complex was, they turned around and they backtracked. But they didn't backtrack far enough. They basically told him he could fly the flag on the inside of his balcony where it's being covered up by the rails. Now, that's insanity within itself. That's a totally disrespect for the flag right there. But, folks, it's the Lodge on El Dorado Apartments in the Houston area, and we will be interested. I'll be interested to see, Rodney, how it goes forward. I was tweeting them and Facebooking on their Facebook page about the time that they put their little release out on their web page, and you can't find it when you go to the main page. You have to go to the link that's in there that they tweeted out and they Facebooked out. It doesn't look like they want people just going to the website to actually see that, wonder why they're hiding it. But, you know, Rodney, it all comes down to the same thing we talk about all the time. They want to take and solve all the world's problems by just taking everything away. They want to totally sanitize the world of any problems, make everything politically correct, don't ever say anything offensive to somebody else, make sure we're working our way to where they're going to even want to decide what we can think and what we can't think. But we can see just that just coming with the progress of history. But, man, it just makes me crazy, Rodney. One time they did that, it was a 90-year-old veteran of World War II. That they had told he couldn't fly his flag. And it infuriates me, Rodney. You know what? It doesn't make me want to cry. It makes me want to yell.
how does somebody determine that someone living in America is going to be offended by the country's flag? It offends Muslims? Are you saying, not you, Scott, but are you the person making this determination, are you saying that all Muslims are offended by the flag of the United States? I mean, I thought the prevailing wisdom was that, oh, you know, Muslims are loving, peaceful, you know, people. And, you know, and I tend to believe that. I mean, there's billions of Muslims, and they're not marching on my house and burning my house down. There's how many Muslims here? 8 million Muslims in the United States? I know people that are Muslim. I know some Muslims very, very well. I'm not doing the old I have friends that are black thing. I just happen to know a lot of Muslims. I live in California, for crying out loud. And, you know, none of them have ever attacked me. I don't have any personal problems with Muslims. So why on earth would you think for a minute that the American flag would offend a Muslim? They're living in America. Well, are you telling me that if they moved to Canada, they'd have to start taking down Canadian flags? You know, what is that?
It goes side by side with this Redskin thing. Poll after poll after poll, they've been doing this for 20 years. Poll after poll has shown the American Indians have absolutely no problem with the Washington Redskins. No problem whatsoever.
Well, they're getting a backlash on that, as I spoke earlier with Joe the Plumber, telling me about that. Because, you know, they actually did, the owner of the Washington Redskins actually has come up with a new name that's far less offensive. You know, that word is so offensive, I guess, at least they say it is to so many people.
that he's come up with a new name that's far less repulsive. He's going with the Maryland Redskins. Did you hear that? Because not as many people will be. Yeah. See that.
Antonio Blanco did basically the same thing. If you go to my Facebook page, you can see my banner. Antonio Blanco is one of my favorite political cartoonists. And
you know, he's with the Alliance now. Did you know that?
Oh, is he really?
Oh, yeah. He's on our team, baby.
And, you know, he's got the Washington all right beating up on him. It's the Washington establishment. And, you know, it really does. It goes every single time when we start getting into these political correctness issues. It is very rarely the people who are being used by the left to deal with this. In fact, even when we come to the gay marriage issue, the bulk of the homosexual community really doesn't care a whole lot about the concept of gay marriage. They want the rights if they're living together, but most of these gay issues is something used to the left. Most blacks, a lot of the stuff that Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton go running around saying are all the problems of the black community, the black community is not talking about all that stuff. They use it as a tool. A tool, number one, to raise money, and a tool, number two, to do changing things. And the same thing's going on here. Most Muslims in this country, I believe, do love America and have no problem with the flag whatsoever. We've seen the same thing go on in California with the American flag at the schools during the time of Cinco de Mayo. And it's always the left using these issues to stir up dissension. As opposed to the people who they're so-called protecting actually even care about it as an issue.
You know, I think that the Republican Party needs to start reaching out to these groups and being a lot more effective. One thing they could do regarding gays, I think Republicans, instead of running around screaming that gays shouldn't be married, I mean, let's be honest, how many of us have had several traditional marriages? And let's just be honest, if you had a business model where 3 out of 5 times it failed, you know, you'd maybe be thinking of it. So, listen, we believe in traditional marriage, but we want people to vote for us. So why don't we, the Republican Party, why don't we come out as the party? We'll be against a gay divorce, you see? So we'll be warning gays about a marriage, and we'll be the good guys. Is that what you're saying, that gays really don't get it? Because, see,
you finally got around to quote.
Yeah, what I see in the news now is gays getting divorced. And I'm just looking at them going, well, you know what? You fought really hard for that. Now you're living the dream there, Jason. Way to go. I'm just kidding, of course. But, you know, there's different ways to get different groups to come around to your way of thinking. And, you know, obviously there's gay Republicans and gay conservatives, obviously. And I work and live in Hollywood for 25 years, and I was a stand-up comic for 12 years. And obviously, I have many friends and associates and people who have worked in business that are gay. And the truth is, Scott, I don't think twice about it. So when there's a big uproar about gay this and gay that, I look at it like, where are these gay people that are running around screaming and stuff? So I tend to think you're absolutely right. It is a handful of people that are just scream their asses off. And yet the other day, I wrote and posted a story about Adam Carolla, our friend, our conservative comedian friend. You know Adam, right?
Oh, yeah.
He came out and he said, you know what? Everybody thinks this. Everybody talks about it. Everybody knows it on the left and the right. But everyone is very afraid to say it in public that there is a gay mafia in Hollywood. And it is the one subject you cannot make a joke about. You can joke about everything except gay. You cannot tell a joke about gay. You cannot, if you have a really great joke about Chaz Bono, you better put it right back in the drawer, because the gay mafia will come out and destroy you. They will huddle together, and they will hurt you. And if you don't believe it, ask Alec Baldwin. Alec Baldwin could not be further to the left. But he's made jokes and he's made, he's admittedly made gay slurs in heated moments when people are, he felt after him or insulting him and insulting his wife and his girlfriend. And I'm telling you, it isn't like any other group, especially in Hollywood. Yet it is dangerous, and you better just keep your mouth shut. And I don't run into people like that, and I never have run into people like that in all my years of showbiz. And maybe I'm just never paid attention, or maybe I wasn't the type of person to make fun of gays. I don't know. But certainly the gay friends that I had never had a problem with me making gay jokes because I do it all the time. But according to Adam Carolla and according to people who live that, it better not be somebody prominent and it better not be in public or your livelihood will be threatened. Now, I'll give you a far better example for this. You better be on the correct side, politically speaking, of the gay issue. And you better have been correct about it for many years. Because not only can you lose your livelihood for merely saying you believe in traditional marriage, if you state that you believe in traditional marriage, you run a good chance of being fired. You run a good chance of being sued. You run a good chance of being harassed. You run a good chance of losing your livelihood, and not just for what you said last week, but for what you might have said 10 years ago. You know what, Scott? You can lose your job for merely agreeing with President Obama. Did you know that?
Oh, that's right.
10 years ago. The CEO of Mozilla, you know that nifty little internet software that you use to get on the internet so you don't have to use Internet Explorer? 10 years ago, he donated $1,000 to a traditional marriage cause. They were fighting for this proposition in California, which passed by a great majority, that basically outlawed gay marriage. It said the definition of marriage is between one man and one woman. So 10 years ago, okay? 10 years ago. Now, he didn't run around screaming about gays. He didn't say anything about gay people. He didn't say anything about heterosexual people. He didn't say anything about marriage. He just donated $1,000 to a group that was fighting for the passage, I believe it was Proposition 8. And he lost his job. He was forced out as the CEO of a large corporation. And at the time that he donated that $1,000, Scott Osborne, our president was running for the Senate on a platform of traditional marriage, anti-gay marriage. So all you have to do is agree with Barack Obama, and you're going to lose your job. That's the country we live in, my friend.
Well, and it's because none of it is based on truth. None of it is based on truth. You know, during the 2008 election, I take that back. It was the 2004 election. Sean Hannity kept coming up with these quotes, and he kept laying them out and then asking who said it. And he thought it was a conservative, and it was John Kerry. it really does. And I guess that's why you and I do what we do, because we like to talk, we like to get the word out, we like to try and explain these things, and hope by some chance that, although a lot of times we're talking to the choir, somebody that doesn't always listen might hear something and really understand it.
excuse me, but it really does go, they all go hand in hand. All of the subjects that we just talked about, the Washington Redskins issue, the flag issue, the gay marriage issue, they're tools that are used by the left. And I think Rich Lowry really did a good job of explaining this earlier in the show when he talked about, you know, the left, their stuff is tangible and our stuff is intangible. Our stuff is a little bit more difficult, freedom and liberty, a little bit more difficult to sell because it's intangible. They have a real easy sell. They just turn around and sell racism. Racism is real easy to sell. They just say that word, and then automatically everybody believes that just we are all racist. And it goes hand in hand. Anything else we need to discuss tonight before we head out?
Well, I mean, we could sit here and do this all night. And it wouldn't bother me, but you're a couple hours later than I am, so we should probably tell everyone, which at this point is really nobody, because we're just talking on tape. But who knows? You people that are listening to this on the archive, let me tell you, let me be the first to say I love you. I love you, and so does Scott. I think I can speak. Did I quote scripture yet? I think I did there with the I love you.
Yeah, you did quote scripture.
Okay, which part? Hey, you know what, Scott? Hold on. I do have one more thing. If you don't mind, indulging me. Because I did pick out something that I thought was, that I thought you would appreciate. I've been thinking a lot about this whole scripture thing. And so I tried to find something in the Bible that would pertain to this show and that would specifically pertain to me, that might help me, and something that you might appreciate too. And I'm glad we talked about this, because I thought all week, God, I'm going to end the show with this, because it'll maybe be something that makes Scott smile. Because I'm trying to find advice, you know, in the Bible. And it's from Philippians 4, and I want to know if you've heard of this one. You probably
13.
I don't know. You've heard Philippians 4. You've heard a lot of them. It's Philippians 4. Do they say subchapter 6?
Correct.
Excuse me. Philippians 4, subchapter 6. Quote, "Don't worry about anything. Instead, pray about everything. Tell God your needs, and don't forget to thank him for his answers. If you do this, you'll experience God's peace, which is far more wonderful than the human mind can understand. His peace will keep your thoughts and your hearts quiet and at rest as you trust in Jesus, in Christ Jesus." God, I screwed up the ending. "His peace will keep your thoughts and your hearts quiet and at rest as you trust in Christ Jesus."
That's right. And you know what he's leading to is verse 13. Go ahead and read verse 13 while you're there.
Oh, I only pulled out that one.
Oh.
I don't got the whole thing. I just pulled out number 6.
All things work together. Verse 13 says, "All things work together for good for them that love the Lord and are called according to his purpose." And, boy, you pulled a good one, Rodney. You pulled a real good one because, you know, when it really comes down to it, and you and I, we talk on the radio, but you and I talk a lot. We sometimes talk for 1 or 2 hours, sometimes just chit-chatting about life. And we talk about taking off and going to some island somewhere, and we talk about the nation falling apart, and the Republican Party is in smithers. But when it all comes down to it, the purpose of my Christianity is not to help me make it through the good times. It's to help me make it through the bad times. And that's what it's all about. And it, no matter how bad things get, no matter how – and I can see this world coming – history repeats itself over and over and over again. I could see some real tough times for us ahead. But as long as we've got God on our side, he's going to help us make it through whatever it is. And God has always used weakness in order to accomplish great things. He used Noah, a single man, built the Titanic of the time. One man.
He used King David, who had sexual problems. He used Moses to go and speak to Pharaoh. Moses kind of stuttered. He had a speech problem. God always used weakness, and he will use our country in times of weakness to accomplish his things and strengthen his church as well. So Philippians chapter 4, the whole book of Philippians, written from jail, actually. Paul wrote that in chains. And so great, great passage there, Rodney. Thank you.
Wasn't a lot of the Bible written by people who were incarcerated at the time?
Oh, definitely. Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, and Colossians were all written by those are the prison epistles. The book of Romans most likely could have been written during a time when Paul was in prison. Peter wrote 1st and 2nd Peter. He had been in prison. There was a lot of that went on. And the reason why, there's a good reason for that, Rodney. The illustration is there. When Peter was in prison, remember, he was in prison, and there was an earthquake, and the light cut through the darkness of the lonely prison cell, and the chains that bound the man of God, I'm quoting Amy Grant, just opened up and fell. And that is the picture of what Christ does for our own lives. He releases us from the bondage of sin. He releases us, just like the Israelites were pulled out of bondage in Egypt. It's the exact same picture. Christ releases us from that bondage of sin, and doesn't, it's like Irma Bombeck said, that life is not always a bowl of cherries. Sometimes it's the pits, but Christianity helps us deal with it when it's the pits, and it releases us from the bondage and the troubles of this world and gives us a better way, kind of like we talked a couple of weeks ago. You said, you know, I'm willing to talk to somebody when they look at me and see something different. That's what they're supposed to see. They're supposed to see us dealing with the world situations a little bit different than everybody else. And we do, because we're free from that bondage.
Well, it's really interesting, and I'll try to find another, you know, passage. I'm just trying to find stuff that, you know, applies. And I've got some stuff from Daniel as well. That's another favorite of mine. And people don't realize the answers that are there. And you know, I'm not trying to – again, I'm not very good at proselytizing, as you know. But when you read something like that I just wrote from Philippians, how do you say that? Philippines? What? How do you say that? How do you say that chapter?
Philippians.
You know, it's very simple. It's basically don't worry, be happy. But it's you know, obviously, here's why. You know, here's a good solid reason why. Don't worry, be happy. Here's what you do. Here's why you do it. And you know, show people that you're the real deal. Show people that you're considerate. Show people that you're unselfish. I mean, that's really what it is. And, you know, it's good, solid advice. I mean, when you meet somebody, and they're obviously, I mean, you can tell right away in a lot of cases, they're obviously unselfish. And they're obviously considerate. Well, what's your reaction, Scott? I mean, most people's reaction when they meet somebody that's obviously unselfish and obviously considerate, what do they do? They themselves become more considerate, or they start showing their considerate and an unselfish side. Am I right?
Well, you're exactly right, and you know, that's what it all comes down to is how you and I, each one of us, interact with the people around us. A lot of times, you know, we're talking politics, so we're talking about society and how it reacts. But each one of us on our individual basis, you know, God tells three very important stories in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. Adam and Eve is the story of the relationship between man and God. Cain and Abel, the story of the relationship between man and man. And the Tower of Babel, the story of the relationship between society and man. And we talk, when we're talking politics, we're talking about the Tower of Babel. We're talking about the story of the relationship between man and society and how society goes. But society only goes the wrong direction when you don't get the relationship between man and God right and man and man. And you know, I think we've gotten to know each other pretty good over the last few months. And I can say for both of us, I think we try and treat people at a certain level.
and treat them with an understanding, treat them with a certain amount of respect, treat them with a certain understanding and forgiveness. And as we do, we make our little circle around us a whole lot happier.
Yeah, you got to. I mean, you got to have, and people that are not religious, or the, even people that disdain religion, or they think it's a turnoff, or they think it's, you know, they have a negative view of it, they themselves will engage in this, and they don't even know it. I mean, you know, a guy that I was friends with we're not such good friends anymore, but we were friends for a very, very long time, 25 years, he would always put down religion, and he was always very anti-Christian and just very, and he was educated by Jesuits, and he had every reason to be thankful for his upbringing, you know, his good spiritual and religious upbringing, but he wasn't. And, you know, maybe there was a reason for that, I didn't know, whatever. But he would always piss and moan about that, always running down religion and always highlighting and emphasizing the negatives. And if there was a story about, you know, in the news about priests, he would just, you know, blanket everybody in the world with that. And, oh, you know, more people have died, you know, throw out all these myths about Christianity. And yet, he would go on and on and on about how great meditating was. And he couldn't stop talking about how the great effects of meditating on the body, on the mind. Oh, I got to meditate. And I would tell him, don't you know that you're just praying?
That's right.
You're getting 50% of the benefit, if that. Maybe you're getting 30%. I don't know. But you're praying. Why not just take the whole 100% while you're meditating? You're there anyway. Don't you understand that God has you anyway? He's got you right where he wants you. And you just need to, you know, flip the light switch. But he would never believe me. And, you know, and there's example after example after example like that. And you reminded me of one. And now, of course, I've ranted so much I can't remember. I can't remember, but when you talk about, you know, there's problems in society because there's problems with man's relationship with man, and then what was the other one? Man's relationship with God, right?
Right.
People won't believe it. People don't want to believe it, and they don't want to believe that there is an answer in the Bible. They don't want to believe that. They don't. And you just flip it open, and it's just unbelievable. You know, to me, I look at it and I go, wouldn't it be great? Wouldn't it be awesome? I mean, wouldn't it just make your day? Like winning a lottery. If you could just go grab a book every time you have a problem, every time there's an issue in your life, just grab, there's a book sitting on your shelf that has all of the answers in it. I mean, that sounds incredible. I mean, it really does. Sounds incredible to me, and I believe it. It still sounds wacky. And people don't want to believe it. But if you look hard enough in that book, it's in there. And if you talk to somebody like Scott Osborne that can, you know, help you, you know, direct you quicker to where what chapter and verse it's in, which isn't too hard to do, it's sitting right there. You know why? You know, whether it's the concept of forgiveness or whether it's the, you know, people will talk about, here's another one, Scott. And sorry for me rambling.
That's all right.
But people talk about karma, okay? They use the word karma, and the Beach Boys sang about good vibrations. And it's all the same thing. It's all there right in Philippians. I can't say that chapter correctly, but you know what I'm talking about. It's all right there. The good vibrations and the what goes around comes around and you know, all of that is right there in that one subchapter 6 verse that says, be considerate, be unselfish, right there. show people, you know, what you're up to. And, you know, when you have a problem, ask God for his advice and be happy when you get the answers. And if that's good vibrations, because when people are around you, if you're like that and people are around you, they'll get your good vibrations. You know, they'll get it.
So very true, and you're hitting on the basic foundation of why we've got the Word of God, and you know, prayer. You hit the nose on the head. God does not need us to pray. If God created this entire universe, and we can only see like what we can look out with our telescopes, powerful telescopes, and see what we think is maybe 10%, and just look at something as small as the flower on a tree. If He could create all that. He doesn't need for us to physically pray. Why does he do that? Because when we talk through something, we help our minds defragment it. If you've ever defragmented a computer, you know, he takes everything off the hard drive and lays it back out, takes all the spaces out and kind of organizes it. That's what our prayer does when we talk to him. You know, people are psychologists in this country make millions and millions of dollars. They don't give a lot of advice. They sit and just listen and let the person talk, because even they know as you talk through these things. And each one of the things that God asks us to do are not there for his edification. They're there because he, as the creator, knows the human being. It's like the owner's manual to the car, and I'll give an illustration on that in a second. But he asks us to sing. There's nothing any more therapeutic than to sing. He asks us to take of the Lord's Supper and remember the death, burial, and resurrection. When we do that, we have a little bit harder time just letting Satan grab us by the heels and go out and live however we want. You know, Rodney, when I was in high school, my girlfriend and I, when we started going to college, we lived in Tulare, California, and was going to go to college in Portland, Oregon. We went looking for a car, and we bought a Yugo. And remember the Yugo back in the 80s, that little tin can? It was quite a car.
Made in Yugoslavia.
Made in Yugoslavia. And, you know, it had a Fiat engine in it. It had a real good engine in it, and it actually it was one of the first ones to start using some beveling along the body. So if you got into an accident, it kind of accordioned a little bit instead of just crushing into you. But it was a fun car. But anyways, we went down. My girlfriend and I went down. My mom and dad co-signed for us, and we got our car that we could drive back and forth to Portland, Oregon. And the first weekend, of course, got it home and set it in the driveway and you know, you go through and look about everything. I didn't read the owner's manual. I knew how to drive a car, right? So Monday morning, got ready to go. And I started the car up, backed it out, and it went ka-thud, 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 ka-thud. Brand new car. Thud, full tank of gas. Ka-thud, ka-thud. Went around the corner. It took me about a block and a half before, and then it started running. And I went, what in the world? This is a brand new car. I was ready to take it back. Worked fine the rest of the day. Next morning, got up. Same thing. Did that all week. Well, the next Saturday, of course, got in and washed the car, brand new car. So you got to wash the car, whether it's dirty or not. Got in and played with the radio, played with a few of the gadgets, got out the owner's manual. And the owner's manual said this: just start the Yugo. It's got a Fiat engine in it. Press down on the accelerator once, press down on the accelerator twice, let up, turn on the key, and let it idle for 30 seconds. So that next Monday morning early when I got ready to go, I pressed down on the accelerator once, pressed down the accelerator twice, turned on the key, let it idle for 30 seconds, and that sucker just backed right out of that driveway like you wouldn't believe it, drove down the roads, never had a problem with it. I had to read the owner's manual to make the car work right. And that Bible is our owner's manual, and it's designed to help us make us work right. Now, man has tried to replace prayer with all kinds of things. We've got psychologists. We've got meditation. We've got all kinds of things. I think in the schools now they're doing these quiet times where the children just sit and think. God had a purpose. God had a purpose for asking us to communicate with him. He didn't have to have us. He knows my thoughts. He knew my thoughts. My thoughts and the problems that I was going to get into when Noah was building the ark. But he asked us to do that. He asked us to sing. He asks us to study. He asks us to get in there and find out what's in there and find out the things that, that help us make it through life better. And you really started out with your scripture that you read of one of the biggest things, and that's our mental attitude towards things that happen in this world, things that happen around us. If we take it God's way and we have an understanding that we know the end of the story and it's all going to be all right, we've got a lot easier walking through the coals than if we don't take that kind of an attitude. And when we do, I'll tell you, it served me well for a lot of years, Rodney. I've been through thick and through thin. I've made some dumb mistakes in my life, done some real dumb things in my life. I had some rough times, had some good times. I've had a lot of money in my pocket at times and zero money in my pocket at other times, but I've always been content. And another thing Paul said was, I learned to be content in whatever the circumstances. And that guy had it, man. He was shipwrecked 3 times. He was beaten the 40 lashes minus one a bunch of times. He was in prison. He was in danger out in the countryside. He was in danger in the cities. And he said, on top of all that, my daily concern for the churches. And if he could be content, I can be content.
Why didn't they just say he was beaten 39 lashes? Why do they have to say 40 minus one?
Because they wanted to, it was 40 lashes was what was given down as the punishment.
Well, then how come he got off?
You always took one off because they wanted to make sure that they didn't go to 41, so they just always took one off. So the actual punishment was 40 lashes, but you never got that last lash just in case somebody miscounted.
I see. And, you know, you were talking about how prayer and, you know, it's like defragging the hard drive, for the brand new hard drive. You know, you were talking about that for a minute ago.
Uh-huh.
I think that's what the IRS did with their computers because they can't seem to find anything. I think they did that defragging thing a little bit too much. And it's a weird transition out of the Bible talk, but I got to go after this because you must be falling asleep because I am. Not because you're boring, just because it's late.
A couple more hours.
I find this fascinating. But the IRS, I mean, it is unbelievable to me that when people are reporting this on television, they just don't burst out laughing. They just don't start chuckling because it's preposterous. It's like you're telling your neighbor that you're, you know, a funny story about what your kid did over the weekend. The IRS has been subpoenaed for these emails that Lois Lerner, who's head of the IRS, who has admitted to denying civil liberties to conservative groups, Tea Party groups, Christians, conservative Jews, etc. She's already admitted it. She's taken the fifth, and for a year now, they've been trying to get Congress, they've been trying to get copies of emails that she has sent to whoever she sent emails. They've been trying to get copies of emails for a certain period of time. I think it was 2009 to 2011. And a year later, the IRS says, well, we don't have them. We lost them. Why? Well, the computer crashed. The computer crash didn't destroy all their emails, Scott. Just that time period that's critical to the investigation. It didn't destroy the ones before that, not after, but just that time period. Okay, well, that's no problem because, you know, computer investigators, what do they call them? Guys can go in there. IT experts can go in and retrieve, it's email. They're somewhere. They're never actually gone. They can go in there and retrieve them. What do they call those guys? It's like a post-mortem.
Yeah.
They can go in, no problem, go in there. Well, that's not going to work either because we lost those hard drives. They were thrown away by mistake. Now, they didn't throw away the hard drives before that period or after that period. They didn't wipe the hard drives clean before then and after, just for the period that's critical to the investigation. We threw those ones away. Those ones have been destroyed. And the six people that it would have been important to see Lois Lerner, so you would think, well, that's okay. We'll just check the people that she sent might have sent emails to. Oh, those six people, yeah, they lost their emails too for that time period, and they destroyed their hard drives too for that period of time. Now, when people are reporting on this, how can they not start giggling, Scott?
The dog ate my homework.
Yeah, and the president ate my dog. I mean, it just, it's so preposterous. It is just like, you know, a child of four can come up with a better answer than not only did we lose the emails that will no doubt put Lois Lerner away forever, and it'll cause her to flip like a pancake and run right up the ladder to, you know, to Holder and probably right up to Obama and his entire reelection campaign, no doubt. But, I just can't see anybody with a straight face reporting on that. Now, are there any Democrats at all that are going, you know what, I've supported this guy through thick and thin, but I can't roll with you on this one. This one is just making people look too foolish. This is just too embarrassing. You know what I mean? People, you know, there was a point where the Republicans turned on Richard Nixon. They just went, dude, the missing 8 minutes on the tape, come on, you know. Enough is enough. You know what I mean, Scott? Is their ideology so important that they'll never just go, yeah, he's a liar?
Well, you know, I think you got two camps there. I think you got the Debbie Wasserman Schultzes that absolutely would stand by it because they like to lie too. But I think you've got the Dianne Feinstein group who are intellectually honest. And there's a handful of senators and congressmen who are Democrats who we disagree with on almost all things ideological, who are intellectually honest, however. And I really think that you're starting to see the media peel away. I think you're starting to see some of these ideologically honest Democrats pulling away. I have been predicting for about 9 months that this summer was going to turn out to be absolutely a horror movie for Barack Obama. And that was without knowing some of these recent things that were coming up to us. I think we're going to find out this summer a little bit more about Benghazi. I think we're going to find out a little bit more about this birth certificate that he put out, Joe Arpaio stuff. Joe Arpaio and his group, and I'm connected in a Facebook group, you're in there too now, Rodney, where these guys seem to think they've got quite a handful of things, not just the birth certificate, but all kinds of stuff. And when they were getting ready to go to release this, they stumbled on some more stuff, which they're investigating. And it's not just a bunch of Tea Party people that are investigating this. These are law enforcement people. This is CSI. This is this is law and order kind of people that are investigating this stuff. I think you've got that. And then I think you've also got the just flat-out ineptness of the administration, which is now what we're talking about with these emails. You know, number one, email doesn't sit on a hard drive. I don't have any emails on my hard drive. My emails are off on the server somewhere with Yahoo or Gmail or wherever the particular email that I'm using is. And it's also in two different places. I've got the email on my side, and I've got the email on the side of the person that I sent it to. So those emails aren't totally destroyed. And wonderful, Roddy, we got wonderful news. We can always ask NSA to hand their copies over. You know what I mean? And I think we've had a congressman, I don't remember which one of them was, stood up there and said, that's all right, we'll just ask NSA for the metafile on her emails. But I think this stuff is going to come out. It's not like Richard Nixon's tape where it's almost impossible to get that 15 minutes back. There is always a data trail, and there is always ways to find this stuff, even if they took destroyed physical hard drives on a computer. That doesn't wash, but at the same time, it does. It makes them look foolish. This is worse than the dog ate your homework.
Well, it just cracks me up. I mean, it's not so much the lies, and it's just obvious. I mean, nobody can say, look, not only did we lose the emails just for the period of time that you want them, but we just found that out after a year of stonewalling. And you asked for them a year ago. We waited a year, and now we've lost them, and they can't be recovered because we destroyed the hard drives. Just those ones. By mistake. By mistake we did that. When was the last time that you pulled a hard drive out of your computer by mistake? That's not something you do by mistake. That is a pain in the butt, pulling a hard drive out of a computer. I know. I got rid of my computer at the ranch, and I didn't want – I don't even know why, but there's nothing in there that – I guess I had my credit card information in there. So I pulled a hard drive out, and I threw it in my outdoor barbecue pit and burned it. It's not easy to get out of there, and I have a stupid gateway computer. Can you imagine? Oh, what'd you do today? Oh, you know what? Oh, crap. I pulled my hard drive out of my computer by mistake and destroyed it. Oh, damn it. I knew I shouldn't have done that. Oh, what was I thinking? Anyway, what cracks me up about this is not the big, is not this Hitlerian series of lies that they're telling. What cracks me up is these poor reporters in the mainstream, especially on networks. If they do report it, they feel like they've got to report it with a straight face, where any human being would go, well, you're not going to believe what they said happened. Next, you know, it's just so stupid. You know what I'm saying? We've gotten to the point where if you're a kid and you're interested in politics, let's say you're 15 years old, wouldn't you go to your parents and go, what are these guys high? What are they high? What is going on here?
Exactly, Rodney. And you know, can you believe that we've worked ourselves up to the 10-minute mark? The third hour. And Blog Talk,
I think it's time to say goodnight. Good night, Dan. Good night, Dick.
Blog Talk is going to cut us off in 10 minutes, but it was a great discussion tonight, Rodney. Always good to talk to Jill the Plumber. Always good to talk to Rich Lowry. Like I say, folks, if you're in archive listening this far, we thank you for listening to all 3 hours. Now we know how Rush Limbaugh feels. But we great discussion with Rich, and he's gotten a whole lot easier on himself, I think, on making some of these things laid out. I think I can see where he's purposely taken the effort to lay this out to a language that everybody around can understand. And so it was just a great show all the way around. Great discussion about the Word of God afterwards, Rodney. We want to remind everybody we've got some other shows going on. Conover U every Thursday night, 9 o'clock Texas time, 7 o'clock California time, and 10 o'clock Florida and New York time. And then on Tuesdays, we've got American Sovereignty Radio at the same time with Jennifer Montrose, I, and Dan Wilson doing that. And then Saturday Symposium with Dan Wilson on Saturdays at 10:30 in the morning on Saturday. Well, I'm sorry, 11 in the morning on Saturday. We changed the time. And then, of course, tomorrow at noon, ladies' Bible class. We're wandering through the Old Testament, having some great discussions on the Old Testament, and looking forward to that. So anyways, Rodney, any closing remarks before Blog Talk cuts us off?
I'm just going to say thanks again, Scott. And next time we have Rich Lowry on, I gotta ask Rich about the honeymoon. Was it conservative or was it Democrat? Or was it liberal? I gotta really turn his face with it.
I know it. All right, my friend.
I'll talk to you sooner than that, I hope.
All righty, we will talk to you. And I want to thank everybody for joining us on Contending for Truth Radio. We've laughed, we've cried, and we've talked ourselves until our mouths are dry. So I want to thank everybody, and you guys have a great day.